Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about the minimum wage bill that's been dropped in the General Assembly here in Pennsylvania. Good, bad? Well, I think pretty good. We'll talk about that. Also, actual family value type legislation being proposed in the U.S. House of Representatives and in Congress? Really? Wow, we'll talk about that. Also, it's the holiday season, time for giving and caring and all of that stuff. The stories of the good, the bad, and, of course, the ugly. We'll talk about that. And the GOP's courting them there. Woman folk. Hilarity at its best. We'll talk about that. Also, your calls, your thoughts, comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. A little bit of history to start the program off. The year was the year 2000. You may remember it well. I know I do. I know this day in history, I remember being very angry. I remember going, we're going to head down the wrong road. As a nation, we're going to be in big trouble. Because this day, today, December the 12th, 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in, stopped the recount in Florida, and the ball began rolling to probably the worst president, the worst Supreme Court, one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in the history of the country, sticking their nose into the heart of politics of the day and actually changing the course of the nation's history. By stopping that recount, which we now know that once the recount was actually done and you got away from all of the politicking and all of the obstruction and all, once the actual votes were counted, Gore won in every conceivable way. And this is the irony that I think is kind of funny. He won in every conceivable way except the one that his campaign had asked for, which was the four counties. Asked to recount the four counties. I forget the name of Dade Brower and a couple around Miami. He would have lost had they given him that. At the time, I remember screaming, "Count the damn votes!" People went to the polls to cast their votes. Every vote matters. Every vote counts, but not according to our Supreme Court. Not according to the Supreme Court of the United States. And, you know, a couple years ago, you may remember Sandra Day O'Connor came out, a little wishy-washy on, you know, if they should have done the right thing. Back in April, actually came out and said they made a mistake. Actually said that, and it admitted, you know, it took the case and it decided it at a time when it was still a big issue. When she told the Chicago Tribune editorial board, maybe the court, she said, should have said, we're not going to take it, goodbye. Let the votes be counted, which is what I was saying. It's not something that they should have gotten involved in. And I thought the Florida courts had it right. You count the damn votes. Count the votes. But if you remember at the time, and I do, you remember the Republican operatives who were masterfully mobilized. They had everything. The only thing they had on their mind was they wanted to win. Democrats, on the other hand, they said, well, what we want is we want rule of law and we want, you know, good governance, which they always do. And they weren't the ones winning the media war, and they lost. And I remember the day that Trader Joe Lieberman went on TV and basically conceded. And it was a nice jab in the back to Gore. Now, again, I go back to Gore, who I was not a huge fan of. But when you look at your two choices, bad and less bad, you go with less bad usually. And less bad, one of the first bad decisions less bad made was picking Joe Lieberman. Why you would have chosen Lieberman, I have no idea. I, in my view, brought virtually nothing to the table. Coming from a very small state that was going to go blue anyway, seemed very, very, well, a bad decision. And what I do believe, and I think back to this time, I do believe 9/11 doesn't happen. I don't think our eyes are off the ball. I don't think you have an entire change in the intelligence structure towards going after Iraq and looking at Iraq. I think, and Richard Clark talks about this quite at quite length, of how when Bush took office, the entire focus of the intelligence community was off of bin Laden, off of Al-Qaeda, and right on Hussein. Maybe you had a president on August 6th who reads the presidential daily briefing. Maybe you have a president who says maybe we should be doing maybe. Look, these are all maybes, but I gotta think that the priorities don't shift that much from the Clinton years, and it's a kind of a seamless transition. What I can say, and what I do believe beyond a doubt, is we don't give away over $1.7 trillion in tax handouts to the very well-to-do in this country in the first tax handout. And then there isn't a second tax handout. We don't have this massively skewed tax code. And at least the tax code of the Clinton years, while not as progressive as I would like, and I know a number of others would like, still a little bit better. And you don't have massive disinvestment in education and healthcare, and maybe you have a little bit different of an economy. Now, I do have to wonder if the collapse of 2008 doesn't happen anyway. Because, look, you're talking about corporatists. Would Gore have done something sooner when the signals were there to just about every economist in the country at the time that Wall Street was getting too big, these derivatives were growing into a monster of their own? I don't know. But I do know those huge tax handouts don't happen. I know Social Security isn't attacked. I know the prescription drug plan that says, hey, we're not going to raise prices and we're not going to negotiate for prices. No, we're not going to do that. We pay full price, damn it, because we're Americans. That doesn't happen. Another huge, huge hand. And really a massive deficit bomb. You know, everyone points their finger at Obama like, oh, the debt and the deficit came because of him. Understand, this trajectory was going well into the Bush years and was going to go well into the next term, whoever that president may be. You know, had it been John McCain, deficits would have been there as well. And would John McCain have tried stimulus spending, or would we have been in a full-blown depression? More interesting questions brought about by this decision. And, you know, you go back to this day, and you got to wonder. What if? You got to wonder. You know, and, you know, I've had these conversations recently, especially around the assassination, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, where you ask the question, what if? What if, you know, that doesn't happen? You know, what does this country look like? What trajectory do we follow? What's the globe look like? This one decision by this body who, they took it upon themselves to jump in the middle of this and award the presidency to George W. Bush. Because to take it away, even if he lost the vote, they ruled would be injurious to him. What about being injurious to the nation? So back in April. She said, you know, maybe the court shouldn't have said it. A couple years earlier, she said, she wasn't sure she made the right call. A reporter for The New Yorker, a guy named Jeff Toobin, he told NPR sometime in April that he knows O'Connor very well, that she regrets her vote, even if she'll never say so. He says, to know Justice O'Connor, as privileged as I am, the word regret never passes her lips. Did she regret the vote on Bush v. Gore? Did she regret the Bush presidency? You bet she did. And you bet she does. The war in Iraq, the war on terror, John Ashcroft as Attorney General, the Terri Schiavo case, all of these things filled Justice O'Connor with revulsion. And you can be sure that her vote in Bush v. Gore weighs on her mind. Well, you know what? I got to be honest. There's something there. I feel for her that she has this weighing on her mind. But look at what's happened to the country. Look at the inequality that has exploded since 2000. I mean, it's absolutely stunning when you look at the numbers. It is stunning when you look at the growth of the very well-to-do in Wall Street and the investor class of this country, the wealth that they control and the power that they wield. And then you look at the bottom 90, 95, 99% of us who get up every day, punch a clock, work our butts off to try and just make it to the next day, make it so our kids have a better shot tomorrow. And it's getting harder and harder and harder. People are working harder for longer for less. That's it's not a cliche. It's reality. And what we've got in D.C. now is total dysfunction. And this was really brought to us heavily during the Clinton years, because you had a lot of money interests going after Clinton. But really, that Bush-Gore election, Bush was the guy who was going to be the igniter. The guy who was going to run the country like a CEO, and maybe he did run it. Maybe he was the first CEO president. And the guy who ran the company into the ground. You know, I think back to going to his presidential library, and I was just talking this afternoon about the Wall of Freedom. And I'm not allowed to know. I guess nobody knows how much it costs to get your name etched in stone on the Wall of Freedom at the Bush Library. I can imagine I'll never in my lifetime make that kind of money. But it was really repulsive. Really, the whole Bush Library, just a testament to failure every step of the way. And, you know, I go back where they started today, when the Supreme Court stopped the recount in Florida. And in my view, some people should have been going to jail for what happened in Florida, but instead, people like Katherine Harris became congresswomen and then went on to very, very lucrative gigs in the private sector because they had done the bidding that they were paid to do. Sad. Just sad. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about the budget. Good deal, bad deal? Right back after this. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of Government Employees says it can't support the bipartisan federal budget deal that requires more sacrifices from federal workers in the form of a pension cut. AFGE President David Cox Sr. says taking a bigger bite out of federal worker paychecks to pay more for their defined benefit pensions will substantially lower the standard of living for federal employees. AFGE says Congress should focus its efforts on repealing the Budget Control Act and not pitting federal workers against the very programs to which they have committed their lives. AFGE members have already given $114 billion to deficit reduction, according to AFGE, and the union says it opposes trying to squeeze even more from the federal workforce. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's shocking that Republicans refused to include an extension of unemployment benefits in the budget agreement. At the end of this month, federal unemployment benefits expire for 1.3 million jobless workers. The AFL-CIO says lawmakers must not desert these workers by not acting to extend the benefits. Trumka says the budget deal offers some temporary respite from sequestration budget cuts, but doesn't represent the clean break from budget austerity that the U.S. economy urgently needs. The Labor Federation notes that this budget agreement does nothing for the millions of Americans still out of work and asks nothing from the people who caused the economic crisis and continue to benefit from income inequality. The AFL-CIO says it's hard to justify demanding more sacrifice from workers while keeping in place costly tax preferences for Wall Street and companies that ship jobs overseas. The Teamsters are calling on IKEA to end a British Columbia lockout of 300 Teamster workers. A representative from the Teamsters traveled to Sweden to urge IKEA to stop the lockout. The Teamster workers in British Columbia have been locked out without pay since May 13th of this year. A delegation of workers went to Sweden to highlight findings of a report titled How IKEA is Hurting Families, report on the IKEA lockout in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. The report outlines the findings of an international fact-finding commission formed by Uni Global Union and the International Transport Workers Federation. The report describes how IKEA has deviated from its original Swedish values and has violated its own code of conduct with the lockout action. The Teamsters say the workers were locked out after voting down IKEA's demands for a wage system that the union says discriminates against workers and forces many workers to give up family health care benefits.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The House this afternoon passed the bipartisan two-year budget deal that sets the federal spending level. No more shutdowns, no more hostage crises for a while. The vote was 332-94. It's believed that the Senate's going to take it up next week, so maybe the president signs it before Christmas. Merry Christmas. What a wonderful, wonderful present for all of us. And as Dean Baker said yesterday, it's good for them, maybe not so good for us. And John Boehner, I guess whenever Boehner gets upset, maybe it's worth it. He's all ticked off. Evidently, the Freedom Works and the people at Club for Growth are attacking him and the legislation, according to him, without knowing what's in it. And as soon as I saw that, I'm going, well, kind of reminds me of the health care law. They were attacking even before they knew it was their bill. Anyway, here to talk a little bit more about that, I've got Pat Garofalo. He is the assistant editor for opinion at U.S. News and World Report. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Good first step? Bad? Is this the beginning of the end of austerity, as I've been hearing? What are your thoughts?
It just seems like kind of a big nothing, honestly. I mean, I guess it's nice that there will be extremely slightly less austerity for the next 2 years. But honestly, at the end of the day, this is an agreement that does nothing for the actual economic problems that we face.
So in 2010, when the Republicans were running around the country saying jobs, 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 laser-like focus on the jobs thing, not so much now.
not so much now, not so much ever, right? Like, I'll certainly take billions of dollars less austerity this year or next year than there would have been otherwise, but in terms of actually putting people back to work, in terms of actually getting people's wages up, this isn't going to do anything.
So what did come out of it? I mean, you're the guy who follows this much, probably much closer than I do. What got cut? What got saved? Why are they excited?
So it's about $60 billion off less in sequestration cuts over the next 2 years, evenly divided between defense and non-defense. And in order to pay for, quote, that, they have slightly more sequestration cuts at the end of the 10-year budget window. So 10 years off, they have some airline fees to pay for it and kind of another basket of cuts, higher pensions for pension payments for government employees at the end of the 10-year budget.
More pay cuts.
Exactly, more pay cuts, basically wiping out the little raise that they just got. So it shuffles money around, federal employees get hurt a little bit, and at the end of the day, it just really does nothing. I kind of have a hard time getting ginned up about this package one way or the other. I'm angry about what's not in it, things like unemployment benefits, things like an actual jobs program. But as to the actual composition of the package, it's just kind of a nothing.
Yeah. You know, the unemployment part of it, you know, to me, I go back to the jobs, you know, because they told me in 2010 that they were going to focus solely on jobs when really their focus has been solely on how to monkey up the system and bring our government to a screeching halt, which they have been very successful at doing.
And how to fire lots of government workers.
And that as well. But I look at this and I go, you know, none of the jobs things that you would expect, nothing to get the economy moving. And in fact, what they've done, you know, especially if the unemployment insurance extension doesn't happen, they're going to make it worse. So this, while it's less bad, it's just less bad.
That's really all you could say about it. Like, sure, I guess we'll take it. Fine, if we have to, but let's not pretend it's an actual solution for anything.
Yeah. Now, they say there'll be no more hostage situations. What about the debt ceiling? Is that anywhere in this?
No, it is not. So no more hostage situations with a little asterisk next to it, assuming that no one takes the debt ceiling hostage when it comes next year.
And is there any talk on how that's going to go? Because I can't imagine that, especially when you're seeing FreedomWorks and the Club for Growth people balking at this, I can't imagine that they're going to be not screaming about the debt ceiling, especially in an election year.
I think that's right. The only good thing to come out of this package, to my mind, the only really good thing is the joy of watching John Boehner yell at Heritage Action. That's really the only good thing that has come out of it. That the pure entertainment value of watching John Boehner freak out at the right-wing monster that he's created is great fun. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. When the debt ceiling comes around, I don't see why the extreme right-wing wouldn't want to take it hostage again. Maybe, possibly, kind of. There are some Republicans who have learned their lesson, but they haven't learned it up until now, so I'm not sure why we would think they'll learn it next year.
Yeah, because, you know, I asked yesterday when I talked to Dean Baker, I said, you know, does this mean we're going to see a Tea Party challenge for Paul Ryan? Because, you know, I look at this, it's kind of a sellout. This is not his budget.
It's not, but at this point, is there anyone left who isn't a rhino in the Tea Party's eyes? I mean, they came after John Cornyn, they're coming after Paul Ryan. I mean, at that point, like, who's left? Louis Gohmert for Speaker? I don't even know what you do anymore.
Yes, that's the guy we want. I love crazy. There's nothing better than, in fact, bring Alan West back.
But, I mean, seriously, the point where you're calling, you know, Paul Ryan and his let's get rid of Medicare budget a big sellout, I don't know, who's left?
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that I'm happy wasn't in here, because there was some talk of changes to Social Security and some talk to, you know, the fix the debt people were pushing a lot of their austerity stuff. I'm glad, I guess if you could take some solace in something, those attacks weren't in there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, for what she was working with, I guess Patty Murray did a decent enough job, the Senate Budget Committee chairwoman. She was kind of in a box. It seems like she got out of it without letting anything really bad happen. So props for that. But, again, it's like we're celebrating nothing bad happening and the situation not getting worse. We're not celebrating the situation getting better.
So coming in there, now I've read some reports here recently that say when they come back in January after they've had their Christmas break and they've had their vacation, which between you, me, and the four walls, I don't think they deserve. If there's ever been a Congress in history that should have to stay after school and work through Christmas break, it should be this Congress, because they're going home with no unemployment benefits. They're going home with no farm bill, which means the SNAP program is going to hurt more working families. There's a lot of stuff undone.
Yeah, we're going to hit the milk cliff soon, too, right?
Yeah.
I think that's in there. You're absolutely right. I've been hearing whispers that they're going to talk about unemployment benefits when they get back. I actually saw a kind of startling stat the other day that I included in a piece that I wrote. The current job openings number, so the ratio of workers who are looking for work to the number of openings right now, is essentially 3-1. It's 2.9-1. They have 2.9 workers looking, actively looking for every available job, which is actually worse than the very worst month of the early 2000s recession. So now, however many months into this recovery, that ratio is still worse than it was at the bottom of the last recession.
Yeah, the second Bush's first recession.
Right.
Because I lived through the first Bush's first recession, which was bad enough. But the second Bush's first recession was pretty bad, got laid off in that, too. So I got hit by both Bush's first recession. Fortunately, I didn't get hit by the big one of number two's number two recession, if that makes any sense.
That does, but that just tells you the depth that we are trying to crawl out of, that this recession, still this many months after the recession ended, this long after the quote-unquote recovery began, this is still worse than it was last time. And so we're talking about cutting off unemployment benefits, but they're just, the jobs aren't there. It's not that these people aren't looking, it's that there are just three people scrapping for every single available opening. And what are they supposed to do?
Yeah. But, you know, if you listen to the Rand Pauls of the world, extending unemployment would be a disservice to those three workers who are looking for that, because then those three people, they could grab match for that one job. Because isn't that really where the conservatives want to take us? You have a ring grudge match. The three of you go in a ring. Whoever comes out gets the job.
You know, if we had Speaker Louie Gohmert, maybe that's where we would end up.
But, you know, for me, and I've been saying this for a couple of years now, the extensions, I've not really been all that in favor of. I keep saying we need to have jobs plans, and I think government should be the employer of last resort, because there's a ton of things that need to get done that, sorry, the private sector are never going to do because there's not any profit in doing it. So I say government should be the employer of last resort. Give people dignity. Give them something to wake up for every morning and something to put on their resume so that they've got jobs and they've got income coming in.
That's absolutely right. I mean, extending unemployment benefits further is something we should do. It's morally right, it's economically right, but far preferable would be employing people to do all the things that we should be doing, and also that we can borrow money really cheaply to do. If the United States were a corporation, the right wing always likes to say, well, we have to run the United States like a business, and we need to get a businessman in that. If a business could borrow money as cheaply as the United States can borrow money right now, and the CEO wasn't borrowing as much as he could, he would get fired. It would be business malpractice to not borrow with the rates that the United States can get right now. And we should be doing everything. We should be covering the country in broadband. We should be putting solar cells and wind farms everywhere anyone wants us to stick one.
And not only would they get fired, they wouldn't get their golden parachute.
Absolutely. There would be no bonus at the end of the year. Can you imagine?
And no $210 million for you, Mr. Nardelli, even though you put Home Depot in the pits. Which just blows my mind. You look at these huge golden parachutes that these guys get for screwing up. Have you ever been fired where they hand you a huge check? I need to find that job.
I can't say that I have.
I need to find that job where they say, get out! Here's a lifetime worth of money. But I want to go back to this unemployment thing, because it's, you hear a lot of people say, well, how much is enough? Is 99 weeks enough? And my take on it is, well, until they find a job, until the economy's back on its feet. Sorry, 7% unemployment's not enough. And when we kick these 2.5 million people off of the extended unemployment benefits, what's that going to do the unemployment number, it's going to drop it down. So it looks like the economy's better. So then I think, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but then I think once the number drops down, we'll be even beating up the unemployed even more then, because, wow, the unemployment number's down, even though there are less people collecting unemployment.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility for the numbers to act the way that you just said. The other concern is that you're just sucking money out of the economy, and so, you know, one of the virtues of unemployment benefits, in addition to, you know, helping people put food on the table, is that that money can then cycle through the economy, because they buy that food, then that helps the grocer, who then has to order more food, and that helps the trucker, and on and on and on. And so the more that you're sucking this money out, in addition to hurting the recipients, you're hurting everyone through that whole entire chain of purchases that are now gone that they would have made.
Yeah, and it's that spiraling. If you take that money out of the economy, you end up costing more jobs to spiraling down, which we used to understand common sense. What happened?
We did, and the way you're talking about it, the way we talk about it is wrong. We shouldn't be thinking in terms of X weeks is enough. It should be people get this until there is a reasonable chance that they will find a job, when the economy is in good enough shape that we think it's reasonable that you will find a job in X amount of time.
No, but, you know, here's the thing. I go back and I argue with some of my conservative friends who are big, huge Uncle Milty fans. They love to spout Milton Friedman, even though I don't know they've actually really read much about him. He came up with this idea of a negative tax. Even if he didn't have a job, he wanted the government to give each person $6,000 so that they would have money that they'd be able to be consumers, because it was good for business. And it was his idea that Reagan ended up taking, which became the earned income tax credit.
Yep. Absolutely. I mean, a kind of minimum standard income, if you will, which is actually something that gets talked about in some econ circles, and Switzerland's actually considering doing. But yes, the idea that you're actually hurting yourself economically by leaving people with nothing. That hurts everybody. That doesn't just hurt the person with nothing.
So I bring it back to the unemployment thing. Look, I mean, it's you know, we've got a governor here in Pennsylvania who points the finger. First, they were lazy, or they were stupid, or they're drug addicts, now can't pass a drug test. Instead of demonizing and degrading people, say, look, you know, we need consumers. The economy needs demand. We need to get people money, get them buying sugar and shoes and, you know, putting roofs over their head and all this stuff, because that's what our economy is based on. Is that the conversation we should be having instead of demonizing and destroying?
Yeah, that's absolutely the conversation we should be having. There's something odd about the fact that right now corporate profits are higher than they've ever been in history, and yet you aren't seeing hiring. Why is that? Because there are no consumers. There aren't enough consumers for these corporations to look around and say, yeah, it actually is worthwhile to invest in a new store because there are enough people out there with enough money to go buy things. So they're just, you know, sitting on the money. And
so let
that's
me get
a rational
this straight.
Choice on their part, but that's not going to help the economy at all.
Let me get this straight, Pat, then, because if I'm hearing you right, all of the tax cuts we've been giving them because, you know, tax cuts create jobs isn't working?
Shockingly, you will find that doesn't work. Businesses don't expand by how much money they are sitting on. They expand by how many customers they have, which I'm sure will stun you to learn.
Wow. I don't think I've ever...
Okay. Do you need to sit down?
But, you know, I think there are a lot of people, because we've been told over and over and over ad nauseum that the only thing that creates jobs is low taxes and deregulation. If we're willing to work in horrible conditions for no money, that creates jobs. And I got to be honest, fundamentally, I completely disagree.
Right. I mean, just like think of a restaurant. What makes a restaurant expand? It's not getting tax cuts. It's having enough customers that you can't fit them in the restaurant, and you need a bigger restaurant.
Well, deregulation. That health inspector who comes in and worries about those bugs running around, that kills jobs. If we didn't have that, then profits would be up, right?
Not going that far, are you? That's what Speaker Gomer would tell me.
So just to wrap this up, back to the budget. Going to pass, you think? Going to get past the Senate?
Yeah, probably. I mean, once it kicks up through the House in such a big margin, I can't see the Senate stopping it.
And Obama signs it.
Some senator might get up there and carp about it for a while, but I really don't see anything getting in the way.
All right, so sometime before Christmas then, right?
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
I would guess, yes. There you go. Slightly less sequester. Have a good holiday.
There you go. Pat Garofalo, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thank you, likewise.
All righty, assistant editor for opinion over at U.S. News and World Report. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Beat up guys.
deeply blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A., and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation? The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed, no say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing, too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
Keep working on to understand the power that's inside.
I got a couple of emails about that. Why are you playing the Pokemon song? Evidently, that, you know, he's just quoting from Pokemon. That's the quote, I guess. Wow. I miss Herman, though. I miss the Herman Cain train. That whole 2012 presidential Republican primary, amazing. I don't know that we'll ever see a time as comical. You had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs running around trying to out-crazy each other. That was just brilliant. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant. But as Pat said earlier, you know, just to see John Boehner lose his mind was probably well worth it. Fuming at the FreedomWorks people and the Club for Growth people, you know, the right wing, really far out right wingers who have been pushing him and giving him money for years, not happy with him. And I loved the, they don't even know what's in it. How can they be against it if they don't know what's in it? Kind of reminds me of when everyone attacked Nancy Pelosi for saying the dumb comment of, well, once you know what's in it, you'll love it. Once the GOP finds out what's in it, because it's their ideas. Most of it, mostly all of it came from them. And it's not surprising to me that, I guess it was just never enough. So here we are. It was what it was. It's, I guess, what they got through. It's what they felt they could get through is what it is, and we will move forward. This being the holiday season, the time of giving today, you know, on one of our stations, they did a Salvation Army radio-a-thon where they raised some $5,000 throughout the day to give to the local Salvation Army to help feed the hungry and give people a place to shelter during the year. And, you know, I said on one of the programs this afternoon, you know, it's great that you're doing this, you know, this time of the year is the time we think about it. But we should be doing it all year round. Homelessness is not something that just pops up around the holiday. It's something that goes on all year long. And I remember when I was doing the food drives that we used to do, the hungry and homeless for the holidays, where I would spend eight days in the box. 8 days 1 year, nine the next, and then 8 years the year after. 8 days. And I remember the winters weren't quite so bad as if you could find a place to get away from the cold and kind of, you know, be just semi-cold, not freezing, it was more bearable than the heat. I mean, you know, when I did it in July, it was completely outrageous. But you see this report out from the U.S. Conference of Mayors who say that the requests for emergency assistance have jumped by 7% across all of the 25 cities that they looked at. That was the average. And that 43% of those in need, 43% of those folks who were coming asking for help, actually had jobs. These are folks who needed the help because the wages they were earning weren't sufficient. Now, they say that according to the Conference of Mayors report, they say that there has been a 7% increase in the amount of food given out. Now, the total amount, 557 million pounds of food for all the cities combined. But even with that, even with the 7% increase, even with the massive number, you still saw 21% of those who needed assistance not getting it. They had to actually turn people away. In fact, in two-thirds of the facilities, they had to turn people away because they didn't have the resources. They didn't have the food there. And more than three-quarters of the cities reported their pantries and their kitchens have had to reduce the number of allowable visits each month. So figure that out. I mean, think about that for a second. You're running the soup kitchen. You're running the food pantry. You're running the shelter, saying, sorry, you can only eat three times a month or five times a month. I mean, think about that. And now what we've got is we've got Congress who's decided we're not going to extend the unemployment. You've got Congress who's decided no farm bill. No farm bill, which means the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, sorry, you're out of luck. Now understand, the SNAP program already back in November took $1.40 per average meal cut. Now what's this going to do? Thanks, Congress. Merry Christmas to you. I know there's a war on Christmas. Yes, I know. They've told me ad nauseum. Now, you've got, in this country, one in six people, one out of every six people in this country are food insecure. And the reality is we know somebody. Maybe we don't know it, but we know somebody. We know somebody who's food insecure. We know somebody who goes to bed hungry. We know somebody whose kids go to bed hungry. And I got to tell you, I think it's flat wrong. So when one of the stations we do our program on did their radio-a-thon today, you know, I had to throw in because I think it's being part of a community. And I think at this time of the year, especially this time of the year, where we're supposed to be thinking more charitably, we're supposed to be thinking more about others than ourselves, now's a good time. And it's the end of the year. You can use the tax break, right? Because we don't want them to have it. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about the minimum wage bill that's been put forth by State Representative Mark Cohen. Quick break, right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the wage is. Everything's raisin, but the wage is. Gasoline, groceries, and our wages. Everything's raisin, but the wages.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So Pennsylvania State Representative Mark Cohen, he's about to introduce a couple of pieces of legislation around the minimum wage. And it's, you know, I've been talking for the last couple of weeks about the last time we raised the minimum wage. And one of the, and look, every time the minimum wage gets increased, there's always the pound of flesh. There's always you gotta pay homage to the chair, if you will. So there's something you got to kick back. There's the sweetener, right? So the last time they passed it here in Pennsylvania, what they did is they wrote into law, along with a bunch of tax breaks and a bunch of handouts and sweeteners, they wrote into the law that said any local municipality, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Carlisle or anywhere, Harrisburg or any city that Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, whatever, any city that wanted to increase their minimum wage locally, that says, you know, in our corporation borders, we're going to have a minimum wage above the state minimum wage. What they did is they made that illegal. So they banned the ability of local municipalities to have any control over the wage structure locally. And that was one of the pounds of flesh in passing the $7.15 minimum wage. Now, the federal government came in, raised the minimum wage to $7.25, and of course, Pennsylvania had to then go up to $7.25 to the federal law. Now, we did nothing between 2006 and now to raise that. We've been at the federal minimum wage. Now, there have been a couple people who have proposed pieces of legislation over the last couple of months. And there was a guy from Philly that wanted to increase it 10 cents, but then index it to inflation. And I know Patty Kim has a piece of legislation that would raise the minimum wage. Well, what Cohen's doing, he's got two pieces of legislation. One would take away that ban, would give local communities the ability to say, you know what, if the big box retailers or if fast food joints in our neighborhood, they're going to have to pay eight or whatever number they set and whatever the voters set. I mean, that's the other part in this. When the General Assembly puts these bans into place, what they're doing is they're usurping the power of the people. They're saying, well, you're not trustworthy. We can't trust you to decide if you can sustain that kind of business in your community. So they pass this. Now, Cohen's bill is going to repeal that and give that local control back. But he also has another piece that's going to eventually raise the minimum wage over the next couple of years to $11.50 an hour. Now, as I understand it, once it passes, in 60 days, his legislation would raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, which is a pretty sizable jump, but I think one that needs to happen. Then after a year and 60 days, 1 year from obviously the 60-day raise to $9, it'll go to $10.10 a year after that. So two years and 60 days down the road after it passes, it'll be $11.50 an hour, which is where then it will be indexed to the cost of living every January 1st. So it's an automatic fix. And we don't have to have these battles back and forth. Now, the question I do have, Colorado has this indexing. 1 year after, I think it was 2009, inflation rate actually went backwards, and they actually took some money back. I'm not sure if that's in this. It may be. And you could make the argument that that's right. I wouldn't want to see it, but it is part of the indexing. So that'll be interesting to see. Now, as I look at this, you think about the federal minimum wage. You think about the poverty line. And according to the U.S. Health and Human Services Poverty Guideline, in 2013, an annual income of $19,530 would put a family of three right there at the poverty line. If a couple, husband and wife, making minimum wage, made that $7.15, they would be at $14,872, less than the U.S. Health and Human Services poverty guideline for the poverty line. And, you know, to me, it's unconscionable. It's absolutely wrong that someone, I don't care who it is, that you go to work, you bust your behind, and you're still living in poverty. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now, the right wing in this country, losing their mind. And I've seen numerous editorials, especially in the Pittsburgh Tribune, which is, you know, a scathe paper, the billionaire paper. You would expect nothing positive on the minimum wage. But I do find it interesting that they went after Obamacare and minimum wage. What it's going to do is just going to put people out of work, because Obamacare is going to make people get health care and make a decent wage. And as I'm reading through this, I'm thinking about all of the subsidies and stuff we've been talking about the last couple of days, and really for the last couple of years. You know, you think of all the money that we give to Walmart. In fact, Walmart, I saw, gets something like $1.2 billion a year in tax breaks. Free land, infrastructure, you know, financing stuff. $1.2 billion each and every year of public dollars. That's one company. You look at the fast food industry, who huge amounts of money. The top 10 fast food companies in the country, we gave almost $4 billion a year to. McDonald's alone gets $1.2 billion. And then you look at these 10 companies together, who had profits of $7.4 billion. Distributed $7.7 billion in dividends and stock buybacks. So you look at this, over $15 billion they had to hand out in profits and stock dividends and all of this stuff, and buybacks and CEO compensation and all this stuff. And they needed our tax dollars? I mean, to me, I guess the question is, and what we have to be talking about, is, and I've been asking this question, are we okay with a low-wage economy that we're subsidizing? I mean, are you okay with the high costs of their low prices? Are you okay with high subsidies, low wages and us funding people to get health care and food stamps and all of those things. People who are, who, this is their life. They're going to be working here for years. Are we okay with that? Because I'm of the mindset that, that work should have the dignity of being able to care for yourself. And that you shouldn't have to, if you're working 40 hours a week and you're busting your behind, you shouldn't have to go, hey, I need health care. It should be what's provided. Now, New York Times did a piece not too long ago that said, had the minimum wage kept pace with productivity gains, the minimum wage would be about $21.72 an hour. Think about that for a second. They keep telling us, well, we need meritocracy. You get paid what you're worth. Productivity has skyrocketed, especially in the fast food industry. And you go, just keeping up with productivity. I don't even want it to keep up with the CEOs and the 1% crowd who had the federal minimum wage grown at the same rate as the growth of the 1%. You know, our Forbes 400 and their ilk, our 1,500 billionaires, had our wealth, had the minimum wage grown at that. You're talking about 212% higher minimum wage, about $22.62 an hour. Which is why you're seeing so many people out in the streets saying, hey, we want $15 an hour. That's a living wage. That's something we can support a family on. That's something where we can have the dignity of not having to take the EBT card, the food stamp card to the grocery store to feed our kids. We don't have to ask for public assistance for heating. We don't have to ask for Medicaid. We can afford it. And I look at this and I keep going back to, is this the kind of economy that we want to have? Now, I've had a number of conversations recently with people saying, well, you know, we have to subsidize these companies because, you know, that's how they're going to survive. I'm going, but hold on. The fast food industry is very profitable. As Pat Garofalo earlier said, corporations are having huge gains. They're doing famously well. And I know. By bringing this up, I'm somehow going to be pigeonholed as anti-business. I'm not anti-business. I'm very much pro the idea that if your workforce creates you the wealth, they should share in the profits. See, but we live in a time right now where we seem to respect more the person who claims to be taking a risk. Oh, I put my money on the line, even though you go, really? I think a lot of studies have shown a lot of the money that's being risked is our money. A lot of the money that's being gambled, our money. And I go back to the Danny DeVito movie, if you've ever seen it, the OPM, Other People's Money, where he never gambled his own money. He gambled people's pension funds. He gambled other people's savings, never his own. How do you think they became billionaires? Not by being stupid and using their own money, right? But I think the movement is growing. And I think more people are coming around to the idea that we need to have a higher minimum wage. We need to have stronger laws and the ability to organize. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back in the second hour, we're going to talk about the Family Act that's been introduced here, 20 years since the Family Medical Leave Act. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of Government Employees says it can't support the bipartisan federal budget deal that requires more sacrifices from federal workers in the form of a pension cut. AFGE President David Cox Sr. says taking a bigger bite out of federal worker paychecks to pay more for their defined benefit pensions will substantially lower the standard of living for federal employees. AFGE says Congress should focus its efforts on repealing the Budget Control Act and not pitting federal workers against the very programs to which they have committed their lives. AFGE members have already given $114 billion to deficit reduction, according to AFGE, and the union says it opposes trying to squeeze even more from the federal workforce. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's shocking that Republicans refused to include an extension of unemployment benefits in the budget agreement. At the end of this month, federal unemployment benefits expire for 1.3 million jobless workers. The AFL-CIO says lawmakers must not desert these workers by not acting to extend the benefits. Trumka says the budget deal offers some temporary respite from sequestration budget cuts, but doesn't represent the clean break from budget austerity that the U.S. economy urgently needs. The Labor Federation notes that this budget agreement does nothing for the millions of Americans still out of work and asks nothing from the people who caused the economic crisis and continue to benefit from income inequality. The AFL-CIO says it's hard to justify demanding more sacrifice from workers while keeping in place costly tax preferences for Wall Street and companies that ship jobs overseas. The Teamsters are calling on IKEA to end a British Columbia lockout of 300 Teamster workers. A representative from the Teamsters traveled to Sweden to urge IKEA to stop the lockout. The Teamster workers in British Columbia have been locked out without pay since May 13th of this year. A delegation of workers went to Sweden to highlight findings of a report titled How IKEA is Hurting Families, report on the IKEA lockout in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. The report outlines the findings of an international fact-finding commission formed by UNI Global Union and the International Transport Workers Federation. The report describes how IKEA has deviated from its original Swedish values and has violated its own code of conduct with the lockout action. The Teamsters say the workers were locked out after voting down IKEA's demands for a wage system that the union says discriminates against workers and forces many workers to give up family health care benefits.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So it's been 20 years since President Clinton signed the Family Medical Leave Act, something that in my lifetime I've been fortunate to use a couple of times when my children were born. I was able to spend 7-8 weeks at home with them to welcome them to the world. And I think, you know, when you talk about family values, this piece of legislation is one of those things you go, it's a step in the right direction. Now, my complaint has always been, now, granted, I was fortunate enough to be able to save up, take those 7-8 weeks unpaid. Very few families in this country can do that. I always said there should have been a pay component to this. There should have been a way that all people would have the ability to access it. And today I understand the Family Act was introduced by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Representative Rosa DeLauro, the Democrat from Connecticut. Here to talk about the Family Act is Ellen Bravo. She's the Executive Director of Family Values at Work, their website, familyvaluesatwork.org. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. How are you doing?
I'm good, and I'm happy to see this, because, you know, I got to be honest, over the years, having taken it a number of times, each of my three children and a sick parent, you go back and you think about that stuff, all the money that the struggle that it was, had there been a paid component to it, would have made it a lot easier.
Absolutely. And let's be honest, when people don't have income while they're out, this is what happens. Either they shorten their leave, They don't get the treatment they need. They have to abandon a child in the neonatal care unit so that they can be at work to make sure that there's food when that child comes home. Or they do stay with the child or get the treatment they need, and they become bankrupt or slip into poverty or, you know, go into a cycle of debt.
Yeah, I mean, when
this
I hear...
As you say, family values have to mean something, and clearly that's not what that is.
Yeah, so walk me through the bill that was the proposal introduced today, the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or FAMLI Act. What is it?
So here's the good news. It's something that exists already in several states, California, New Jersey, and now Rhode Island. It's a social insurance fund, works just like an insurance. The idea is you pool your money. Everyone pays a little. And then when you need it, you can draw, in this case, up to two-thirds of your wages for up to 12 weeks. And you can use it for the same reasons that you use family leave, for the arrival of a new child, whether by birth or adoption, or to care for a seriously ill family member or your own personal illness. It's done by very modest contributions. 2%, 0.2% of your payroll, both by employee and employer.
And I understand that's capped, right?
Say that again?
I understand that number is capped, much like Social Security is capped at $113,000. This is capped as well. I think the number I saw was like $240 a year was the maximum that could be paid into it.
Right, exactly. So it's a small amount of money, and it's pre-tax. And the good news is that when you need it, it gives you a significant portion of your income and makes it realistic for a lot more people to take the time they need to care for that loved one or to take care of themselves without facing a really hard financial hit.
Now, is this tied to the Family Medical Leave Act, where you've got that number of you got to be an employee with 50 employees or more? Is it tied
to
that?
Well, here's the good news. What isn't tied, every single one of us will pay into this fund. We'll all be able to draw on the fund, whether we work for a very small employer, whether we've worked there for a year. As long as we pay into the fund, let's say I'm there 8 months and then I move to another job, I've still paid into that fund, I can still draw on it. So it's much better than the FMLA in that sense. The challenge is going to be, will there be job protection for people who aren't covered by FMLA?
Right, because that was my first thought right there.
Right, and so the new state, Rhode Island, has a very progressive aspect to it, which is that everyone who takes the leave will have their job when they go back. And that's what we want, and so we're hopeful as we work to pass the Family Act that we'll be able to improve it to include that feature now that Rhode Island has it, and particularly since this bill, you know, isn't going to move with this Congress, we'll have some experience from Rhode Island and we'll be able to show that, in fact, it's a good thing. Isn't it all of our goals to keep people employed?
Yeah, absolutely.
Businesses and the economy as well as families. So, you know, we're hopeful that we'll move toward that more progressive.
But the thing is that gets me is the people who are going to be most against this are the people who tell with quite loudly and from the highest mouth that they're the party of family values.
Yeah, they sure do. And, you know, it's why we made our name Family Values at Work, because we want it to mean something. And just as I'm not giving up the word life, I'm not giving up the word family, and I'm certainly not giving up the word values. I just recently testified in Pennsylvania for a bill that would, you'll love this, expand the definition of family so it includes siblings. I'm not sure when family stopped including siblings, particularly as a twin. I can't even imagine that. But the truth is FMLA doesn't cover siblings or grandparents or grandchildren or in-laws or lots of other people who are very important to us. And when we went to testify for the bill, the Senate sponsor came and he said, you know, if we talk about family values, we can't just say it, we got to do it.
Yep.
And that's what these kind of minimum labor standards will help ensure.
But the thing that's interesting to me, Ellen, is that I think most people, you know, most people who don't pay attention as closely as I do, or maybe you do, or some of our listeners do, think that these benefits are already there. And I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people who said, you know, I'm going to use the Family Medical Leave Act. And I said, have you saved money? Because there's going to be nothing coming. And they go, well, there's nothing? Because I think there's a belief that this already exists.
I know. So it's interesting. There's a real class divide on this, though. I mean, people who I've met lots of people, particularly anyone who's, you know, lived a while abroad. I know someone, for example, we have a booklet of stories of folks who used FMLA. And, you know, this is someone who lived in Canada and, you know, had paid leave when she had her first child and then moved here to have her second child and couldn't believe that there was no paid leave at all. It just seems so extraordinary. On the other hand, low-wage workers, you know, they've come to have very little expectation for what compensation they're going to get.
Right.
That doesn't mean they don't need it, and it certainly doesn't mean they don't want it and now are beginning more and more to demand it. But I think their expectations are much lower.
No, I think their expectations are, I want to eat today. I'm not going to have to worry about what's tomorrow.
Right. And that's right.
And this is all part of that fight. And since you brought, because one of the questions I was going to ask is, since you brought up the woman who lived in Canada, doesn't the rest of the world kind of look at us with a jaundiced eye going, what's wrong with you? You talk about family values. You thump your chest about how, with your religiosity and how pious you are. And yet you don't have this very basic minimum thing that the rest of the industrialized world takes for granted.
You know what's interesting? I had my first child in the late 70s, and I had a good friend who lived in France who wrote me a letter saying, I feel so sorry for you that you have to have this baby in the United States. And I was just shocked. You know, I've been around the block. I thought I knew a lot, but I had no idea how badly we look in comparison to the rest of the world. But, you know, it isn't just the wealthy industrialized countries. In 1995, I went to Beijing for that big conference of women, and there were people there from newly freed post-apartheid South Africa. And they were talking about how the struggle they had to expand their three-month paid leave to 6 months.
Wow.
So many countries, Kenya, Iran, Mongolia, they all have some kind of paid leave. There are only three countries in the world that are the outliers, you know, and it's Swaziland.
So what company do we keep?
Swaziland, Papua New Guinea, and the United States of America.
Wow.
It's quite appalling. We're the lowliest of the low.
So is this possible? I mean, you know, I understand this is going to be a Herculean leap. There's a lot of work, I'm sure, to do just on the education front of telling people that it doesn't already exist. Is it possible this term, or is this something we're building for the next election cycle and beyond?
Well, I think it's interesting. Yes, we're building for it, and it will take longer than a year. And the good thing is we'll get some new wins in the states. We'll keep, paving the way. But I also think we win automatically by introducing it because we begin to see where people stand. We make a clear message to politicians. This isn't just good policy, it's good politics. Voters care about this, and it can energize voters to get out to vote, and it certainly helps determine who they vote for. And so you're seeing more and more, for the first time really, some efforts by elected officials to have an economic agenda for women that includes, smack in the middle, the issue of paid leave. They're realizing that women voters are the ones who determine elections and that they care about more than reproductive health. That certainly matters to them, but their economic health, their family's health matters to them as well.
Yeah,
so I think it's really good that we're making this a much more visible, high-profile issue to get politicians to take a stand on.
But if I could jump in there for a second and throw my male point of view in, this is important to men as well. Because, you know,
bet.
I mean, I was the main breadwinner. Well, actually, I was the only breadwinner when our children were born. And to take that time off and to be able to be part of those first couple weeks of life, I can never go back and have those again. And it was one of the greatest times and memories of my life. But had I not the job that would have been given me the ability to save some money, I would have missed out on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And so one of the things that's helped galvanize this movement is that more and more men are getting involved. And, you know, I think it's one of, it's not that men didn't want to do this before, but there wasn't really a vehicle. We didn't have these coalitions that gave them a place collectively to raise this demand. We have a wonderful video that's on, I urge your listeners to go to our website, www.familyvaluesatwork.org, and look at the blog, the top blog on valuing families through the Family Act. And there's a link there to a video of a dad in New Jersey who had twins that were born early. They had to be 69 days in neonatal care. And the doctor said, sorry, these babies can't go to daycare till they're 6 months because their immune systems are too fragile. And so because they've won paid leave in New Jersey, this man and his wife were able to stagger their leave and be home that those, you know, during that whole time. And it, he said, not only did it make a difference, obviously, for the babies, but what it, just what you said, what a treasure it was for him to have that time with him, how it's changed everything. They're now 2.5. He said, I never thought I'd have inside jokes with my 2.5-year-olds. And that's what, you know, that's what kids need. It's what women need for men to step up, but it's also a joy for men. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It's a great thing.
No, but
the
it's,
truth
it's what's...
is, though, that disproportionately it is still women who take the leave. And so appealing to women and, on this basis, I think, is a smart thing.
Yeah, but I would say that's mostly economic. And by taking, by doing something like this, I think, I truly believe you're going to open that door up. And I think you see a lot more men going to it. So let me ask you this then, because, you know, I know the pro-business, we need, the people who are going to say we need to be more business friendly, you know, those regulations and those taxes are killing business. And they look at this as a, another entitlement that's just too expensive. We just can't possibly saddle business with this massive expense, even if it is good for our society.
Well, I got good news for you. First of all, we have business partners in every one of our coalitions. It's not the business community. It's the lobby for the mega corporations that are going to make that argument. A lot of small businesses are grateful to see this happen. They can't afford for you to take off to be with your baby, but they sure know it's a good thing for your family, and they'd love to have you do it and then come back to work for them. And this is going to make that possible because it's an insurance fund that will, you know, be very cost-effective and have this terrific payback that people can stay employed. It's very expensive to replace people. You know, people... there's not a line item in most budgets for turnover, but there is a line item for HR, for training, for hiring, for advertising. And the line that isn't there is the get up to speed time. So everyone, you know, every smart business person knows that, so how expensive that is. And this cuts down on those costs, keeps people employed. So that's a really good thing. The other thing is, we have a body of evidence. We have enough experience now in our own country, in our own companies, both people who do it voluntarily, but also these states that have this exact kind of social insurance fund. And the evidence is in. There's a new book out by Eileen Applebaum and Ruth Milkman called Unfinished Business. And it talks about California. And they found there was no negative or there was a positive impact on productivity, on profitability, on, you know, the bottom line for employers. It was a non-event at worst, and at best, a good event. And these employers often said, you know, I heard it was going to be a big deal and it was going to cost me a lot of money. It just didn't happen. Wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we're helping to defeat the doomsayers among those lobbyists who are trying to, you know, convince elected officials, oh, don't vote for this. It'll be a burden on business, when in fact, it'll be a boon and a boost, both for jobs, for families, but also for businesses and the economy.
Yeah, and productivity. I mean, happy families make happy workers. If you don't, if you're not worried about what's going on at home, you can concentrate on what you're doing there. So let me ask you a last question. How do we get this pushed through? What should our listeners be doing? What are the marching orders? What's the action?
Sign up on a website like ours so that you can get alerts and know what's happening, know where your elected official stands. Make your voice clear and share your story, because everybody has one, whether it's a positive story like yours and the benefits, and you want that to be true for everyone, or a negative story of someone who had to go back to work too soon. Lots of men will tell you they take only a couple of days and they really regret that, tell that story. Tell the story of going back before you were well enough. Tell the story of people in your family or circle of friends who put off treatment because they couldn't afford unpaid leave. And if you had experience, again, a positive one, about being able to get the treatment you need and therefore kept a parent from having to go into a nursing home because you were able to help them recover, share that story too. That's what's going to do it. When we put faces to the statistics and we let our voices be heard together, that's where we have power. And also let candidates know, where do you stand on this? Especially union members. When someone comes to your union, ask them, do you support a bill like this? And if not, why are you even here? Why are you daring to ask for our endorsement if you don't stand with working families?
I'm with you. Ellen Bravo, I appreciate you taking time for us. We look forward to hearing from you again as this continues down the road. But thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Take good care.
All right, Ellen Bravo, Executive Director of Family Values at Work. Their website, familyvaluesatwork.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Ellen's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. More working people. Come to talk.
I see the blue for me and you.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A, and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed. No say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
This is
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, and I look at this, and as I'm thinking about, you know, this Family Leave Act, which I think is fantastic, and wish would have been in effect, you know, 11 and a half, 12 years ago, when my daughter was born, when my oldest daughter was born, because I took the longest time off with the first one. I think it was like 8 or 9 weeks, then I think it was 7 with each of the other two. But I was very fortunate that it was there, that I was able to keep my job. They paid my health and welfare, so I kept my insurance going, but no money. And I had said it from the time, I said, you know, even if it was, you know, setting up something on the state level where when you take this, you get unemployment for a couple of weeks to help subsidize it, that's what I would say are family values. And it's amazing to me the people who tell me or purport to be these great champions of family values, how they're the ones who stand in the way of this stuff. And I remember the fight, you know, for Family Medical Leave Act back in 93. It was nothing assured, and there were lots of ideas and things in there that got stripped and gutted out that would have been beneficial for you and me and other people who work for a living. But again, it's this canard, it's this nonsense, oh, it's bad for business. Yet the rest of and as Ellen pointed out, the rest of the world, we're in with Papua New Guinea and Swaziland, which I defy most people to find on a globe. That's the company we're keeping. I guess good for us, right? And I look at this and I go, the family values people. You know, the good GOP, I look at this Seth Grove piece of legislation, which I've talked about a number of times. And I cannot grasp the fact that these are the people who tell us how pious they are and flaunt their religiosity, and then say, well, you know what? And, oh, my favorite one, we believe in local control and the rights of the people and blah, 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 blah. Seth Grove, the Republican representative, put a piece of legislation forward that would take away the ability of local governments, be it your township, be it Philadelphia, or you know, anywhere, to say that in our borders, we're going to make sure that workers have access to paid sick days, to paid vacation, to paid family medical leave. So they're going to consolidate that power into the hands of the state. And why do they do that? Because they know it's much, much more difficult to get something passed at the state level than it is at the township level or the local level. It's much more, and as they know, it's much more difficult to get things passed at the federal level than the state level, which is why they put these roadblocks in place, because they don't want to see this movement. They don't want to see this ball rolling, where you start looking at a place and going, what, you've got paid sick leave? You've got paid sick? You've got days where if your kids get sick, you get to go home with them? And you don't get fired, and you get paid for it? How's that working out? It's not costing a ton of money, and it's not killing business. It's not a job killer. Well, how do we get that? That's what they're afraid of. And what's interesting to me is it's that theft of local control. And why? Because they don't want you to have paid sick time. So it's going to be interesting to watch in the coming days, weeks, and months, and then in the next couple of years, because this Family Act, it's not going to pass in the next year. But it'll be interesting to see the attacks against it. And we know what they are. It's the same attacks that they throw at us about the minimum wage, isn't it? Oh, it's going to kill business! Yet I think, as she pointed out quite aptly, that's actually better for business to maintain, to retain those workers that are trained and during that time when they're away, and then have them come back happy and not broke. I think it's a smart thing to do. And for me to then go, okay, well, we're going to have a program to do it at the state level or the federal level, seems to be rational. A big pot of money. Now, the other part of this is who manages that pot of money? And do we allow it to end up in the regular budget? And do we let politicians spend it on other things? which again, I go back to, you know, today in history. I go back to the 2000 election where Gore was talking about a lockbox. One of the very few things I absolutely agreed with Gore on, that we lockbox Social Security and not use it for everything else. For me, I look at this and go, maybe that concept should come back again. But I'm happy to see that something was passed. And again, if you want to take a look at the plan, familyvaluesatwork.org is the website. Or you can click on Ellen Bravo's name. It'll take you right there. Let's take a quick break. I'm right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got to get older tonight. We got to do it today. No more madness than you. No more mystery. We got to get older tonight.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of Government Employees says it can't support the bipartisan federal budget deal that requires more sacrifices from federal workers in the form of a pension cut. AFGE President David Cox Sr. says taking a bigger bite out of federal worker paychecks to pay more for their defined benefit pensions will substantially lower the standard of living for federal employees. AFGE says Congress should focus its efforts on repealing the Budget Control Act and not pitting federal workers against the very programs to which they have committed their lives. AFGE members have already given $114 billion to deficit reduction, according to AFGE, and the union says it opposes trying to squeeze even more from the federal workforce. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's shocking that Republicans refused to include an extension of unemployment benefits in the budget agreement. At the end of this month, federal unemployment benefits expire for 1.3 million jobless workers. The AFL-CIO says lawmakers must not desert these workers by not acting to extend the benefits. Trumka says the budget deal offers some temporary respite from sequestration budget cuts, but doesn't represent the clean break from budget austerity that the U.S. economy urgently needs. The Labor Federation notes that this budget agreement does nothing for the millions of Americans still out of work and asks nothing from the people who caused the economic crisis and continue to benefit from income inequality. The AFL-CIO says it's hard to justify demanding more sacrifice from workers while keeping in place costly tax preferences for Wall Street and companies that ship jobs overseas. The Teamsters are calling on IKEA to end a British Columbia lockout of 300 Teamster workers. A representative from the Teamsters traveled to Sweden to urge IKEA to stop the lockout. The Teamster workers in British Columbia have been locked out without pay since May 13th of this year. A delegation of workers went to Sweden to highlight findings of a report titled How IKEA is Hurting Families. Report on the IKEA lockout in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. The report outlines the findings of an international fact-finding commission formed by UNI Global Union and the International Transport Workers Federation. The report describes how IKEA has deviated from its original Swedish values and has violated its own code of conduct with the lockout action. The Teamsters say the workers were locked out after voting down IKEA's demands for a wage system that the union says discriminates against workers and forces many workers to give up family health care benefits.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So an amazing week at NYU. It's been, I guess, in excess of 8 years that they've been fighting for collective bargaining rights. And by an overwhelming majority, 98%, the 1,247 NYU graduate student workers are now members of the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, here to talk about the campaign, the fight, and the victory is Matt Canfield. He's an NYU graduate student employee. Matt, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Congratulations. Huge victory. 98%? Is that right?
That's right. 98% came out to vote yes for our union, GSOC, and set UAW over the last 2 days at NYU. It's just a landslide victory.
So where do you go from this point? I mean, this is a huge victory. Eight years in the making. Where do you go from here?
Yeah, 8 years in the making, and boy, have we just been waiting for this moment. And I think that's really what you see when you have 620 workers come out and say yes. We are right now kind of just celebrating, and our next steps obviously are sitting down with our members, talking about what matters to them again, and forming a bargaining committee. And I think we are going to go into bargaining really strong here with such an incredible mandate to bargain.
And you know, I look at this, and 8 years. Why does it have to take this long? You know, I've talked to numerous people over the years who have gone through this process, and it seems to me that we're one of the few countries in the world that it takes this long. Where, and I know I've heard it before, Matt, where, well, the employer has to have the opportunity to tell their side of the story. I've heard that a million times. I never understood why it takes this long.
You know, it's not even 8 years for us. We've been organizing for 15 years, and NYU is the first private university to have a graduate employee union. Of course, you know, private universities or public universities across the country have had unions, and it's typical for schools like University of California, University of Washington, Wisconsin. These are all schools with powerful graduate employee unions. So we started back in 1998. You know, we had a union, and then they ended our contract, and so it's been 8 years. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this long. I think that's really what the tale of this story is, because it took us 8 years. We were waiting for an NLRB petition, and we said enough was enough. Our health care costs went up by 33%. We couldn't wait any longer. And eventually the pressure that we were able to put on the administration, the support that we got across New York City and New York State politics, it really worked out. And we made this agreement with the university to allow us to form a union. And, you know, it doesn't have to take this long, but we're excited that, you know, we finally kind of achieved this victory, and now we are an organized workforce.
That's fantastic, and congratulations. But you brought up health care, and I don't think a lot of people think about, you know, graduate students, graduate assistants, as, you know, people who need health care. But, you know, it's a basic thing that, you know, when I was in college, I didn't have health care other than what the crummy plan the school had. So if I would have gotten sick, you know, who knows what would have happened?
Yeah, and you know, that, and you know, it's a story that is told that we know all across the country. You know, our health care system is broken, and we require health care from our employers. And it can't just be crappy health care. Of course, you know, when we get sick, we need good health care. And so for graduate employees, you know, graduate employees are around for a long time. They take somewhere between 5-7 years in graduate school. And during that time, of course, lots of things happen. People have kids, you know, it's a time that it's important to be taken care of and to have good benefits from your employer, just like we expect across this country, because that's how our country works.
And from an employee standpoint, because, you know, I think it's important that people understand that you're really employees doing a lot of the work that, you know, I always thought, you know, professors were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and we're seeing that really across the country. I mean, graduate schools are important because they provide the labor for schools to have such high enrollment of undergraduates. And so our labor is key to the whole university system. And because we're there for so long, of course, we need the benefits that are given by employers, and that's, you know, why we consider ourselves workers, why we are workers.
Yeah, especially in this day and age where education costs have gone so high, that have skyrocketed so high. You know, I've got friends who went to college back in the 60s, and, you know, one of my friends said, you know, she went through the University of Michigan undergrad all the way through her law degree, working a minimum wage job, walked out not owing a penny. And, you know, that's impossible today. So, you know, the kind of work that you're talking about should be compensated at a rate that can afford you to be able to pay for your education, at least.
Yeah, and, you know, we've seen tuition costs just rising so quickly over the last few years. I mean, if you look at the University of California system, you see a whole university system that was the object of envy for the entire country, and so quickly have their tuition rates skyrocketed. NYU is one of the most expensive universities in the country. And, of course, you know, we are arguing that we need to be compensated, but I think it really also speaks to the importance of organization within higher education, because we need the voices of those who are working in these places to be heard. And I think one of the things that we feel like, just like teachers' unions feel like, we have the best interest not only of our colleagues and other workers, but also of our students in mind. And so I think this puts us in a position to really be an advocate for improving the university as in making it better.
I mean, that's the sentiment that gets lost when you hear people attacking people organizing, folks like you and my teacher friends, that they really truly do care about their students. And I know for some it's hard to imagine, but, you know, in a lot of cases, and a lot of the teachers that I know, they actually put their students ahead of themselves and their own families when it comes to some economic concerns.
Yeah, you know, people get into teaching because they love it. You know, people don't go into teaching because it's going to make them a millionaire. And I think, you know, that's something that we always have to remind ourselves when we come back to education. You know, teachers, and especially, you know, teachers in across all spectrums of the education spectrum are people who care deeply about their students. And we need to remember that these are the people who our institutions should be built around. And we've seen at places like NYU, but across all universities, administrators being, you know, increasingly responsible for decision making. And that's what, you know, we think organization does. It gives us a share in arguing and in making our institutions better. And so, you know, we're excited as graduate students now and graduate employees to be organized, to be able to have a voice, and to really come to the table as equals.
Do you see your victory, this really monumentous victory, as the spark that begins organizing across the country for graduate employees?
Certainly for graduate employees at private universities. You know, back in 1998, when we first started organizing, there was no graduate employees that were organized at private universities. And quickly, they started sprouting up. And we had graduate employee unions start at Tufts University, Yale, University of Chicago. And, of course, what we saw was an anti-union backlash from these employers, from these universities, who went back to the National Labor Relations Board under the Bush administration, and they withdrew our status as employees. Now, I think that, and I've talked personally to graduate employees at lots of institutions who are looking at our victory and saying, it's now our turn to organize. And, you know, it's really important that they do so, because we are seeing transformations in higher education so quickly that we need to respond to them with effective organization. And I think we should look to the labor movement as a model for that.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, and this is why there's such a fight over the National Labor Relations Board, the power of that institution. I mean, with one stroke of the pen, they took not just your right, but all of your fellow graduate employees, your rights away with just a stroke of a pen.
Yeah, you know, we've seen that the National Labor Relations Board, and particularly I think our case proves that, you know, some of these decisions are flipped around. They're political. It's a political body. And so what we need to do is start building power from the ground up. That's what organizing is all about. And, you know, we don't need to wait for the National Labor Relations Board. We need to build power in our workforces, and then we need to make agreements with the administration to form unions. And we can do that. That's what we did at NYU. And we're going to go out and encourage our colleagues at other institutions to do the same.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, having a voice on the job is always much better than not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, having a voice is key. And we have to constantly remind ourselves that the voice of working people are going to make our institutions stronger, and they're going to make them more equal and they're going to, you know, be really more representative institutions in those cases. One of the things that is I feel really strongly about is that, you know, having healthcare, having good benefits at a place like NYU makes it more inclusive, makes it more diverse, allows all different types of people to enter the academy who otherwise would not be able to. And that's what we want. We want a diverse academy. And I think that that's something that, you know, we stand to really change by having a union.
That's an excellent point. I mean, when you have the benefits and you have the ability to make a living, you're not just going to get the elite who can afford to work basically for free or whatever the conditions are because their parents or family may have money. But it opens up to as you said, a wide diversity of thoughts and ideas.
And, of course, then there's the importance of being organized, because I think one of the things that is going to be really powerful is that now we have graduate employees who are part of a union, who are joining the labor movement, and that is something that they can talk to their students about. I mean, I think one of the things that's really exciting for me is to see how undergraduates are responding to our victory, and to see that, you know, the importance of the labor movement wherever they go. But it's something that we can begin to talk about, and, you know, that's something that I think is why
that's
really
huge.
It's important to have organization in all forms of education, because
yep.
That's something that we need to be talking to the next generation about.
Absolutely. That's probably the most important point of all of this. And I got to ask is that could that be possibly one of the main reasons why they fought so hard and pushed back so vehemently? Because they didn't want that culture of organizing that could grow, that they wanted to squash it when they had the chance?
You know, that might be, but I think when it comes down to it, no employer wants to lose power. And that's why unions struggle, because no employer wants to lose their decision-making capacity. And the truth is, if they're going to be equal and they're going to be inclusive institutions, they need to have the voices of the workers. And so, you know, that's been the story here for sure.
Well, congratulations on this huge victory. I know the last time we talked to you, you were hopeful. Guarded optimism is probably the best way of putting it. But congratulations, huge victory, and I wish you guys the absolute best going forward.
All right, thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Matt Canfield, NYU graduate employee, now union member. Good to them and his co-workers. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
This is why we fight, why.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, as one of of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
Yeah, the $350,000 a year base with the $1 million bonus. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Today, a little bit of history today. The year was 1787. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania became only the second state to ratify the Constitution. The vote was 46-23. Now, understand, at the time, Pennsylvania was the most ethnically and religiously diverse states in the nation. And in fact, a third of the Commonwealth spoke German only. And the Constitution printed in their native tongue of German. Yeah. Think about that. Imagine if we had to get the Constitution ratified today. Do you think you'd hear some voices screaming that way? Oh, English only! Because that's the way it's always been done. That's the way the founders wanted it. Except here in Penn's Woods, here in Pennsylvania. Amazing stuff. Also today in history, the year was 2006, where the U.S. immigration, the ICE people, swept into the Swift meat plant. Six Swift meat plants across the country, and arrested about 1,300 undocumented workers, bust them all up, crated them up, shipped them back to Mexico, and the conservatives said it was good. Insane. Just nuts. Anyway, I saw this, and I wanted to go... I wanted a whole rant on this, but I got to... This guy who's the head of this, the CEO of this hackathon organizing site, Hack Angel or something like this, or Angel Hack or whatever it is, evidently decided that he had been traveling, walked back through the streets of San Francisco, and decided that he would let his frustrations out on Facebook, where he writes, "Got back to San Francisco, I've traveled around the world, and I gotta say, there is nothing more grotesque than walking down Market Street in San Francisco. Why, the heart of our city has been overrun by crazy, homeless, drug-dealing dropouts and trash. I have no clue. Each time I pass, my love affair with San Francisco dies a little.
The degenerates, you know, they gather like hyenas. Some of the comments, you got a lot of the degenerates gathering like hyenas, spit and urinate. They taunt you. They sell drugs. He didn't do himself any good because he goes on just some really very elitist talk about how there are other cosmopolitan cities across the country and across the globe where the lower part of society, they keep to themselves, he writes. They sell small trinkets, beg coyly, stay quiet, and generally stay out of your way. They realize it's a privilege to be in the civilized part of town, and they view themselves as guests, and that's okay. In the downtown San Francisco, here's where he goes into the hyenas. They gather like hyenas, spit, urinate, taunt you, sell drugs, get rowdy, act like they own the center of the city, like it's their place of leisure. In actuality, it's the business district for one of the wealthiest cities in the U.S. It's a disgrace, and I don't even feel safe there. And, you know, he goes into this whole long rant about how they should know their place and how they should, you know, stay to themselves and basically be out of his sight. Now, he then does the I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, I know my board is upset at me, so I have to make this half-hearted I'm sorry. What's interesting is this is a guy who, you know, my producer says has done some charitable work, and you gotta wonder, you know, what exactly this guy was thinking, or is this what they say to themselves? They do their charity work because it looks good, it's tax deductible, and it's good PR, but really deep down inside, they really don't want anything to do with the unwashed masses. And you look at a lot of these cities, and look, you walk into some of these downtowns where you have large numbers of homeless people. Lots of them have mental health problems. And I know a couple years ago I got into trouble on the program, back during the Rendell years when they had closed the state hospitals. I got into trouble from the governor's office and the mayor's office, and a whole bunch of people jumped on me when I said, when I was doing the food drives, that I had met a lot of people who were suffering from mental illness and that they had gotten kicked out of the state hospitals. Well, everybody, it was bipartisan. They were all, no, we took care of them. And maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but I was meeting tons of people who were struggling, not with drug and alcohol addictions as we've been sold. We've been sold that all those people are just drug addicts and lazy and drunks. The sad reality is these are people who truly have mental health issues, and that if you get them medication, if you get them treatment, they can be productive members of society. So they say, well, you know, there are these people who, you know, they're no good for society. You know, I guess we live in this throwaway society. It's easy to throw away people, and it's easy to throw these statements out. But for me, it comes back down to, again, those priorities of our budgeting. When we gut social service spending, when we sell off the state hospitals, when we close access to folks who are struggling, when we block grant money. In fact, I just talked to someone today who was telling me that someone they know who, you know, has struggled with drug addiction, has struggled with mental health issues, has struggled with a whole bunch of things, but once they got on the right medication and started the right course of treatment, they were decent, upstanding citizens. And then Corbett comes and cuts all the funding, and there go their meds. And now they're back off the meds and back struggling and in trouble. It just seems to me very short-sighted, and this just seems like another rich guy going on a rant because he had to see a poor person. It's sad stuff. Let's take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. If you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Right back. It's
exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of Government Employees says it can't support the bipartisan federal budget deal that requires more sacrifices from federal workers in the form of a pension cut. AFGE President David Cox Sr. says taking a bigger bite out of federal worker paychecks to pay more for their defined benefit pensions will substantially lower the standard of living for federal employees. AFGE says Congress should focus its efforts on repealing the Budget Control Act and not pitting federal workers against the very programs to which they have committed their lives. AFGE members have already given $114 billion to deficit reduction, according to AFGE, and the union says it opposes trying to squeeze even more from the federal workforce. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's shocking that Republicans refused to include an extension of unemployment benefits in the budget agreement. At the end of this month, federal unemployment benefits expire for 1.3 million jobless workers. The AFL-CIO says lawmakers must not desert these workers by not acting to extend the benefits. Trumka says the budget deal offers some temporary respite from sequestration budget cuts, but doesn't represent the clean break from budget austerity that the U.S. economy urgently needs. The Labor Federation notes that this budget agreement does nothing for the millions of Americans still out of work and asks nothing from the people who caused the economic crisis and continue to benefit from income inequality. The AFL-CIO says it's hard to justify demanding more sacrifice from workers while keeping in place costly tax preferences for Wall Street and companies that ship jobs overseas. The Teamsters are calling on IKEA to end a British Columbia lockout of 300 Teamster workers. A representative from the Teamsters traveled to Sweden to urge IKEA to stop the lockout. The Teamster workers in British Columbia have been locked out without pay since May 13th of this year. A delegation of workers went to Sweden to highlight findings of a report titled How IKEA is Hurting Families. Report on the IKEA lockout in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. The report outlines the findings of an international fact-finding commission formed by UNI Global Union and the International Transport Workers Federation. The report describes how IKEA has deviated from its original Swedish values and has violated its own code of conduct with the lockout action. The Teamsters say the workers were locked out after voting down IKEA's demands for a wage system that the union says discriminates against workers and forces many workers to give up family health care benefits.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So with the holiday coming up, we're here at the program, going to take the last couple of weeks of the year off to go and, well, be with our families, re-energize, actually learn who my kids' names again, because we spend so much time doing this. It's good here at the end of the year to take a little time, spend with the families. But what we're going to be doing is replaying our People's Tour for America. So if you missed it the first time around, if you missed any part of it, an excellent opportunity to go back and revisit that time we spent on the road. And in the process, I'm going to have Pat Lamar sit in for me for a couple of days, who is doing an amazing job writing the book. You've got to read this book when it comes out. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How are you, Rick? It's so rare that we're in the studio at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, busy. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to a little bit of break before the election next year coming up. So much coming up next year. Looking forward to that. But a little vacation.
Yeah, all I can think of when I think about the election next year is that book I love called Confederacy of Dunces. You know, it has been exciting though this year. I mean, 2000. The other thing that happens that we will miss when we come back, because it'll be after 2014 has begun, is every radio broadcaster, TV broadcaster, everybody will be doing the year in review. This is what happened as the year, blah, 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 2013, memorable things of 2013. Possibly the most important, I think, to the world was Pope Francis.
Yes.
Because he's kicking some serious butt, and if he mobilizes 40 million poor people for love, woe to you haters.
Well, like I've been saying, he better dust off the bubble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know. Isn't that awful? It's just amazing. And he's fearless. And he snuck out of the Vatican the other night to go feed the homeless and hungry. God love him. Anyway, but one of the other, I mean, one of the epic things from 2013, certainly for my life, will be the People's Tour.
Yep.
Amazing time. I love your kids. I'm glad you're going to get reacquainted with them. If someone said, and I think someone did, it was you, you're going to get in an RV for a month with three little kids.
What was I thinking?
Yeah, what were we all thinking? But the kids were fantastic. And Sammy, your oldest, does figure in the book, you know, quite a bit, actually, because she spent so much time with us. And she was an amazing grown-up, you know, really playful. That's what I said in the book. She was the important one who reminded us on pretty numerous occasions it was time for ice cream. But she also did a champion job of helping us with the interviews and all kinds of other things. And it was just amazing and remarkable. And working on the book has been such a labor for me for two reasons. One is it's shocking how much of the history of the United States I didn't know, considering I majored in it in college. And then the other thing, why didn't anyone teach me labor history? I'm frustrated. But the other thing is it's just amazing that there are resources to find out that stuff aren't really out there.
Yeah. So, no, I just had a conversation, you know, bringing up labor history and kind of why it isn't taught in the schools. If you remember the uprising in Wisconsin back in February of 2011,
mm-hmm.
I have said that the reason that happened was because in Wisconsin, eighth graders across the state, by law, as a matter of law, have to be given a semester of labor history. So when we were out there sleeping on the floor of the Capitol during that time, talking to the organizers of that event, you know, it kept coming back to, you know, I remember from eighth grade labor history class, the governor calling out the National Guard, shooting workers in the back. Time and time again, that kept coming up. And, you know, there's something to that. If we learn from our past, we hopefully don't make the mistakes of the future. So when they heard Scott Walker say, we're going to call out the National Guard to take over those jobs, those kids, those college kids said, no, we're not reliving that again.
Yeah. It also really reminds us that the largesse, this is, I think, one of the things that struck me the most, is the largesse that was just handed over to corporations. Well, the naivete to think that the Wall Street bailout was the beginning of bailouts, you know, when you think of, this country was given to the railroads.
Yep.
Given to the railroads. And then, I never thought of this, I've read an amazing number of wonderful books to write this book, you know, doing research. But one of the reasons that 40 acres were given to anyone willing to go on that land rush was so that the railroad would have customers.
Gotta have customers.
It wasn't like they didn't think they could just get the successor to the black slave out there, you know, they could get the successor to the enslaved Africans, which would just be the enslaved low class, which, of course, there was in pretty much every industry. They knew they could get the enslaved out there to grow food if they wanted to. No, they wanted customers. They wanted farmers. They wanted little towns. They wanted railroad stops inside the railroad place. And you know, you talk about giving food stamps or some sort of welfare to people to get them on their feet until they're productive on their own. What do you call giving the entire Midwest to the railroads?
And not to mention, I mean, we're still subsidizing the railroad industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're still doing this. And I
don't mind.
I don't either.
I don't mind subsidizing the industries. I'm just saying, why is there all of a sudden something wrong with someone getting a decent wage from a subsidized industry? You know, and why is there something wrong with demanding a decent wage from the? We're subsidizing Walmart by paying for food stamps for their employees.
Yeah. And not just that, bank tellers, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. Right, all the whole low-wage economy that we've allowed to spring up around us. So, again, and going, you know, the next couple of weeks, we're going to be replaying the People's Tour for America. And going back and thinking about that month we spent on the road, what are some of the things that really popped out in your mind? You go, oh, my gosh, one of those moments that just made it all worthwhile. Because it was a rough month. I mean, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of on the go. Was there one thing that popped out, a couple of things?
I got to tell you, it's the most difficult thing I've ever done, and I've run for Vice President of the United States. I've never done anything as difficult as that month.
Spending a month with me is a difficult thing.
Well, it wasn't. It was the intensity.
Yeah.
On top of all the traveling, and on top of all the gathering of information, and on top of all the, you know, just sensory overload, and on top of having three little kids along, and on top of all the rest of that, and having to do this ballet at night to get everybody's crap off the bed so that we could make beds out of them and sleep.
Yeah.
On top of all of that, we had to produce a three-hour show. I mean, it was just amazing undertaking.
So what you're saying is, as people are listening to the next couple of weeks of programs, think about all of that stuff that went into it, yeah. all of the ballet to get people into their beds where they could sleep, that we used for production space, we used to eat on, we used for all of that stuff. And think about the 9,800 miles back and forth across the U.S. and all of that in just a month.
And when you hear those crazy interviews in between, when we were, not interviews, but segues in between when you and I were talking to each other, going 75 miles an hour down the highway, you know. And by the way, the speed limit was 75.
Yes, it was.
Very obedient. I would say that the best paragraph, oh, God, please, I wish it was paragraphs. The best chapter in the book is the George W. Bush Library.
Oh, love the Shrub Library.
Yeah, it was the most fun to write. It was horrifying to write it, but it was all pretty real. That was the other nice thing about doing a radio show, was we had the interviews. So if my notes were at all in question, I just went back and listened to the interviews. West Texas was devastating, you know, to see the complete devastation of that town. I'm still stuck on the Washington and Oregon stevedores, who, after they had gone to Washington to lobby for these foreign companies to get upgrades to the docks, got locked out of their jobs.
Hey, thanks so much for all the work you did.
Yeah.
Here's the door. Don't let it hit you where the good Lord split you.
Yeah, and how incredible is that? They get these guys to go down and say, look, please help these companies because it's our jobs. And then once the companies get the money they want from the U.S. taxpayer, they screw these guys? Horrible.
Well, isn't that the American way?
Ugh. Cherry, Illinois.
Yeah, another one. Yeah. The mine disaster there.
That was also amazingly fun because, well, I love people of extremes, and the guy who built the little model, wasn't he a doozy?
He was amazing. And the painstaking effort he put into making this little life-size, this miniature model of the rail yard and the mine and all that, just, you know, intricate work that I got to be honest, I don't have the patience for.
I don't have the patience. I couldn't have photographed it, you know, let alone actually built it. But you know what I'm really grateful to him for? Because as I did research on other things, some of them mining, but other things that we went to, there were terms used that I would never have known without his little model, like tipple. You know, I wouldn't have known what a tipple was, and
right.
I wouldn't have. And his model and his painstaking diagram, as you said, it explained things to me so vividly. You know, he was really a neat, interesting character, and the little old lady that ran the library.
Wasn't that the cutest little library in the world?
Yeah, and she remembered the people who had told her the stories, because she was so old.
Yeah.
You know, when the people that lived through it were so old when they told her when she was young. That was pretty neat. I loved it. I think the one that I'm,
You know, for me, what it was is, you know, to go across the country and see just how diverse and how unique some places across this country are. I mean, you bring up Cherry. I mean, that was, to me, a step back 100 years in history, in my view.
Yeah.
I mean, just to see the diversity of the country and the amazing topography and all of the, just an experience that will last me a lifetime.
Now, I don't want to embarrass you or anything.
Okay, here it comes.
The other thing that I thought was really neat was traveling with this mama bear, daddy bear thing. because it was, when I talk about it being the most difficult thing I've ever done, and, you know, as far as throwing myself at something and accomplishing it, and I've lived in homeless shelters all over the country, too, this was harder, more difficult.
So hanging out with me is harder than... Nice.
But you guys, you and Carol, your wife Carol, you really were the mama bear and the papa bear on this trip. And that was when you think of everything we went through and everything, I didn't have to plan any of it. I didn't have to. All I had to do was pick my feet up and go, right? And all of the background work that was done. You know, there were things like every day scrambling for a place to sleep. That's probably one of my other memories I like most is we had left the Grand Canyon and we were headed for Nevada. And just after we crossed into Nevada, we figured, well, you know, nobody had had much of a night's sleep. We talk about the valet because there was a 6 or 8 foot table that was up on Carol and Rick's bed that had to be moved every night into the
My bad idea.
Yeah. Well, at least we had it for that one place in California where there was nowhere to do an interview, and boom, we set up a little sound studio. That was pretty cool. But we parked in a hotel, and you and Carol went into the hotel, and Brett and I stayed out in the RV with the kids. And we all thought it was a brilliant idea. I'm sure you thought it was brillianter. But we all thought it was a brilliant idea because the next morning we had the shower that was in the hotel room for us all to use. But I had gotten up and done my morning walk to get coffee or seek out coffee. And I came around the bend, and there was Lake Mead. But we had come in so late at night, we didn't know where we were, really. Or I didn't. And to just come around the corner and have this vista of absolute ungodly beauty of this huge crystal clear blue lake in the middle of the desert. Just amazing. It was like, you know, it stops your breath. Stuff like that was just really fun.
Yeah, and those are things that, you know, like my kids, even today, keep throwing, hey, I remember this happened. Oh, I just remembered this. And, you know, I'm hoping these will be things that they will, you know, they'll cherish for a lifetime. And I'm fortunate that we had the opportunity to do it. And I'm glad that we're going to be playing these 2 weeks again, because I think there's so much good there. And I'm looking forward. I'm actually, as insane as I am, I'm actually looking forward to doing it again.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Good luck on your own, right?
Oh, I'm not saying that, but boy, wow. Well, we learned a lot, too. Yeah. You know, we learned a lot.
I got to see the Wall of Freedom. I got to see the Wall of Freedom.
Ugh, the Bush Library.
Yeah. I get to see the people who own the country right there in
stone. I think you may have read this part of the book already, but you know that no one would tell me how much it cost to get on that wall.
And I asked.
And I made 7 or 8 phone calls after we got back, and I kept calling and badgering. Remember, he gave me the woman's name for the foundation?
Right.
Badger, 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 badger. And I'm a pretty good nag.
Yeah, you
I
are.
Mean, I'm not an ex-wife or nothing. And I could not, to this day, I do not know how much it costs to get your name carved in stone.
It must be a pretty hefty sum.
It must be, because the electronic version is only, your name's only on it for a year. So once you've paid your $100 or whatever to be in the electronic version, and there are all different sliding scale amounts, if you don't pay it again the next year, they take your name off the freedom. You no longer get freedom. You're no longer in the freedom registry.
Wow.
You're only free for a year. And so the wall, then, not so easy to rub your name out when you haven't done it for a year. So though I'm thinking that was a very sizable sum, because they're shaking these people down year after year to be on the electronic registry.
Well, it's good fundraising, though, isn't it?
Well, you'd think after 20 years that's $2,000, right? At $100 a pop.
Wow.
So this has got to be tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to be
millions,
on that wall.
If not millions.
Oh, good Lord.
Because, you know, the names on there, all recognizable billionaires who we have given quite a hefty sum of subsidy to and our tax dollars to. We've created those folks.
That place was amazing. Amazing. And it was really nice to have Sammy, your daughter, along, because on a whole pile of these trips, because she saw things from a very different, far less jaded point of view, you know?
Yeah.
It was quite remarkable to look at things through the eyes of an 11-year-old.
But I'm looking forward to the encore presentation of our tour. I hope our listeners are as well.
Oh, that's what I wanted to say. Memphis, if you don't get to hear any other encore performance, make sure you hear Memphis. And I don't know what night he's going to be on, so you have to listen to them all. But wasn't that incredible interviewing the sanitation workers?
Absolutely.
The ones that Martin Luther King Jr. died for?
And who still don't have pensions? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... and then you ask is the question, have we realized the dream? I mean, he was there for economic justice as much as he was anywhere for civil justice.
You know, when he was talking about making people equal, he was all right. When he started talking about equal economically, that's when he had to go. And it was amazing doing this research. A federal grand jury found law enforcement officials complicit in his murder, and nobody was ever charged. In the 1990s, a federal grand jury brought indictments, and nobody charged the members of the law enforcement organizations with it. They just let it all fly on that phony James Earl Ray story.
Wow. Another, will that be in the book?
Oh, yeah.
Another reason to buy the book.
Yeah, you kidding me? I did all this work, Eric. You're reading it, dang it.
Well, I look forward to it. I look forward to you the next couple of days taking over for me as we head out of town for a little rest, relaxation, and a little Christmas holiday in the sun. I appreciate it. I appreciate you taking time for us. Pat, look forward to working us together in the new year.
Yeah, have a wonderful Christmas.
Yeah, you do as well.
Thanks
so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science folk. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
There's a growing army of the working poor in our U.S. of A., and big contingents of it are now on the march. They're strategizing, organizing, and mobilizing against the immoral economics of inequality being hung around America's neck by the likes of Walmart, McDonald's, and colleges. Wait a minute. Colleges? You go there to get ahead in life. More education makes you better off, right? Well, ask a college professor about that. You know, the ones who earn PhDs and are now teaching America's next generation. The sorry secret of higher education, from community colleges to brand-name universities, is that they've embraced the corporate culture of a contingent workforce, turning professors into part-time, low-paid, no-benefit, no-tenure, temporary teachers. Overall, more than half of America's higher ed faculty members today are, quote, adjunct professors, meaning they are attached to the school but not essentially a part of it. It also means that these highly educated, fully credentialed professors have become part of America's army of the working poor. They never know until a semester starts whether they'll teach one class, three, or none. Typically, this leaves them with take-home pay somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000 a month. Poverty. Adjuncts usually get no benefits, no real chance of earning full-time positions, no due process or severance pay if dismissed. No say in curriculum or school policies, not even office space. Like their counterparts at Walmart and McDonald's, adjunct college professors are not treated as valuable resources to be nurtured, but as cheap, exploitable, and disposable labor. This is Jim Hightower saying, unsurprisingly, this contingent of the low-wage army is organizing too. For information, contact New Faculty Majority at www.newfacultymajority.info.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So the woman who famously quipped, only the little people pay taxes. You may remember her, the Queen of Mean, Leona Helmsley. On this date back in 1989, she was sentenced to the slammer. That's right. She was sentenced to 4 years in prison, 750 hours of community service, and a $7.1 million tax fraud fine in the great state of New York. Only the little people pay taxes. And in the trial, you found out that her personal fine, the furnishings in her house, written off as business expenses. In fact, some of the stuff that they'd gotten so much money. You go, how do you become super rich? And you know, this is one of those things that makes me go, this is how the billionaire class was built. The Helmsleys were they were the stereotype, man. When they touched a quarter, the eagle screamed. According to the trial, they would extort, contractors or, the people who would want to furnish their hotel. See, we'll buy the hotel furnishings, but you have to give us furniture. You have to give us whatever it is we need so we don't have to buy it. And what was interesting is, their contractors hated them. And I often wonder why they did any work for them at all, because they were hardly ever paid on time, if at all. And you'd have to sue them to get money out of them. So it was interesting. I remember that whole time that, they got away with all of this stuff. And, famous stories of her buying really, really very expensive jewelry in New York City and then having empty boxes sent to Connecticut so she didn't have to pay the taxes on it. Because, they made their money, by not paying taxes. They evaded paying what they were supposed to, and they evaded paying the taxes on things that they bought. Which is, hey, if you could get away with it, you'd probably be a little richer too. Maybe not to the tune of $5 to $10 billion in the property holdings, because Harry bought up a whole lot of stuff. Harry was the husband, of course, one of the wealthiest people in the world at the time. $5 billion is what he was worth, about $5 to $10 billion at the time. Think about this: 89, one of the very few billionaires in the country, one of the very few in the world. Think about the mass consolidation of wealth into the hands of the very few since that time. And the other thing that sticks with me when I think of the Queen of Mean, how she got the name. The people who worked for her hated her. I mean, really, she was just a mean, ornery, nasty, cheap person that, you just kind of go, did you have to be that nasty and ugly? Yeah. The kicker, though, the judge sentenced her, publicly reprimanded her by saying, your conduct was the product of naked greed, the arrogant belief that you were above the law. Here's 4 years, 750 hours to commingle with those people, and we're going to take some of your money. Another time, a couple years later, she ended up getting some money taken from her as well. A former, someone who worked for her, sued her for discrimination. Evidently, she fired him solely because he was gay. The jury ordered Helmsley to pay more than $11 million in damages, which you kind of got to go, wow, fire me, please. 2007, she died. She passed away at the age of 87 and left $12 million to her dog. Her workers, nothing. And very, very cheap. Amazing stuff. Amazing developments. An amazing development. Microsoft has, this is for you ladies, because I know how much you're worried about your figure. And it just kind of, this really sexist to the next level.
engineers at Microsoft, they have developed this new high-tech brassiere. You can have it. You can have your brassiere, ladies, linked to your smartphone. And it'll tell you what kind of mood you're in. Because according to research, they think that that eating and your mood have something to do with each other. They have a new paper out that they've laid this all out. Food and mood, just-in-time support for emotional eating, which this bra, this brassiere, will clue you in. It'll send you messages. It'll let you know when you're about ready to eat so you don't. And then you get a smaller size. Happy about that? and to kind of highlight that, you know, a very Republican response. I can't even. I really can't. One of the candidates who's running for the Senate in Iowa, he said that women need to they need to be talked to on an emotional level. Yeah, he says that I think you have to connect with women on an emotional level. And with a wife of 25 years and 18-year-old daughter, I've had a lot of coaching on that. So I'm good at talking down on you, and I'll listen too. What's interesting is the Republicans realize they have a problem. The Republican National Congressional Committee, they're offering tutorials to staff members, men, and people who are thinking about running for election. So you don't have another Murdoch situation. You don't have another Aiken situation where you say something stupid like legitimate rape and you end up losing the seat. So they're holding classes on how to be decent human beings. They're holding classes on how not to offend the women folk. Maybe by offering them a diet brassiere. I mean, I saw that story and I'm going, that's gotta be fake. It's gotta be fake that Microsoft would be spending a whole boatload of money on research trying to come up with a brassiere with enough sensors in it that would tell you, you're stressed out, don't eat. And I would imagine that's what comes up on the phone. You're at a level of where you might be stressed out. Please don't eat. We want you anorexic. According to the article, the brassieres will not end up on the shelves anytime soon. So you got to kind of wonder what the point was. The battery life in it lasts about 4 hours. I don't see women rushing to plug in their brassieres anytime soon. Sitting, I can just see that, can't you? All having at the table, everybody having their. Never mind. Just is what it is. Maybe I should be taking one of the Republican courses on how not to. Interesting story, fake news did a thing over the weekend. A segment titled, Do You Need a Husband? And their guest is this woman who was the founder of a website, Women for Men. And her argument was pretty simple. You need to be like your great-grandmother was. Because men don't want independent women. You know, she said financial independence is a great thing. But you can't take your paycheck to bed with you. And she said, and there's nothing empowering about being beholden to your employer when what you really want to have is a baby. I can't make this stuff up. Just plain nuts. Her name's Suzanne Venker. She uses her opinion to advocate that women should have less of a role in the workplace and let men be the breadwinners so that they can stay home, have babies. There you go. Nice. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of Government Employees says it can't support the bipartisan federal budget deal that requires more sacrifices from federal workers in the form of a pension cut. AFGE President David Cox Sr. says taking a bigger bite out of federal worker paychecks to pay more for their defined benefit pensions will substantially lower the standard of living for federal employees. AFGE says Congress should focus its efforts on repealing the Budget Control Act and not pitting federal workers against the very programs to which they have committed their lives. AFGE members have already given $114 billion to deficit reduction, according to AFGE, and the union says it opposes trying to squeeze even more from the federal workforce. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says it's shocking that Republicans refused to include an extension of unemployment benefits in the budget agreement. At the end of this month, federal unemployment benefits expire for 1.3 million jobless workers. The AFL-CIO says lawmakers must not desert these workers by not acting to extend the benefits. Trumka says the budget deal offers some temporary respite from sequestration budget cuts, but doesn't represent the clean break from budget austerity that the U.S. economy urgently needs. The Labor Federation notes that this budget agreement does nothing for the millions of Americans still out of work and asks nothing from the people who caused the economic crisis and continue to benefit from income inequality. The AFL-CIO says it's hard to justify demanding more sacrifice from workers while keeping in place costly tax preferences for Wall Street and companies that ship jobs overseas. The Teamsters are calling on IKEA to end a British Columbia lockout of 300 Teamster workers. A representative from the Teamsters traveled to Sweden to urge IKEA to stop the lockout. The Teamster workers in British Columbia have been locked out without pay since May 13th of this year. A delegation of workers went to Sweden to highlight findings of a report titled How IKEA is Hurting Families, report on the IKEA lockout in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. The report outlines the findings of an international fact-finding commission formed by UNI Global Union and the International Transport Workers Federation. The report describes how IKEA has deviated from its original Swedish values and has violated its own code of conduct with the lockout action. The Teamsters say the workers were locked out after voting down IKEA's demands for a wage system that the union says discriminates against workers and forces many workers to give up family health care benefits.
This is a very sad day for 100,000 workers who are wondering what their future will hold.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years.
Say if a machine breaks down, they would actually take gray duct tape to tape it up.
Listener support is vital to keep these worker voices on the radio news airwaves. Support Workers Independent News now by donating at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
News of the day, this is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Let's find out what's going on around the world, Washington, D.C., across the globe. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure.
So, final report on the chemical weapons assault. Did it happen? Did Syria use chemical weapons on their own people? What's the line?
Well, first off, I mean, this sort of surprised me that this report was dropped today. This issue had, you know, even though it's gone to the region, I mean, I had almost forgotten about Syria and everything else that's going on right now. But this report is out. It covers more than just the incident that everyone was talking about a few months ago in Damascus. This covered six additional sites. And I will broadly recap it and say that at three of the six additional sites, it was found that soldiers were actually, the Assad armed forces were targeted by the opposition. And at two sites, civilians were targeted. At the two remaining sites, they couldn't make any conclusions. But essentially, this coming one day after Washington, the State Department more specifically announced that it was going to be suspending the delivery of non-lethal aid to the Syrian opposition, I think we can start to see why it's so difficult for those folks in Washington to speak with any confidence about the composition of the opposition in Syria, now that there's, at least from the UN's angle, pretty conclusive proof that they had at one point possessed and fired chemical weapons themselves. So this issue rearing its head again.
So who used the chemical weapons, or did they both?
Yeah, the report concludes that chemical weapons have been used between the parties,
okay,
the language they use. forget that in three instances specifically, soldiers were targeted. Presumably, again, this is, I'm sure we went through this, and you've seen that when the UN made its report about the Damascus attack, they were very careful to sort of leave out saying exactly where the weapons came from. They gave trajectories and the like, which allowed other agencies like the New York Times and the U.S. government and the White House to sort of triangulate who was presumably responsible for the attack. We don't have that kind of detail in this report, but, you know, it's pretty clear from a lot of the maps they provide about where certain strikes happened that the parties being targeted were clearly military installations. They weren't soldiers, for example, caught up in a civilian neighborhood, and both were playing at the same time. These were attacks directly against the army. So unless you want to dive in more deeply and really start pulling out conspiracy theories that the outside government was gassing its own soldiers as a way of blaming the opposition, I think the reality here, tough as it may be, for some people to admit it, that the various elements of the opposition have possessed and used chemical weapons themselves this year.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't put it past any of them, and I go back to my original position, which is the George Washington position. Stay clear of foreign entanglements. Let them deal with it.
Well, it looks like that's what's going to happen here. I mean, again, this news on Wednesday about the State Department stopping non-lethal aid. I mean, this is like health provision, the gas mask, and certain types of food aid, body armor, nothing, no guns directly, but even that is being suspended.
So go back to that for a second, because for a moment there we were talking about, and I had a number of people come on the program and say, well, we should be arming the rebels. I'm going, whoa, that got us into a whole heap of trouble back in Afghanistan, and look where that got us. So now looking at this report, had we gone full tilt boogie and said, here, have a bunch of guns, here, take this, what would this now mean?
Well, I don't have enough confidence to say. You know, we didn't supply any sort of military assistance to these groups that have now been found to have used weapons. Again, it's hard to know which of the 1,200 opposition groups could have been behind these chemical weapons attacks, so I don't want to jump to any conclusions. But when I was in Jordan, we did hear sort of, you know, people speaking on background about the ways that certain opposition groups were being helped, militarily speaking, with lethal types. Officially speaking, we delivered primarily non-lethal aid. But there were instances of helping out scattered groups of the opposition with weapons and the like, at the very least providing them training with weapons that were provided from other neighboring countries. So there is going to be some difficult explaining to do here, but it looks like Washington is getting out before any further complications could arise. I think, you know, the combination of this report and then the State Department's decision on Wednesday signals pretty clearly that that calculation that John Kerry had tried to make back in September, that only 15% to 25% of the opposition were bad guys that we wouldn't want to deal with, is not really the position that the U.S. has anymore. I think the numbers have to be a lot worse than that to decide that even non-lethal aid is too risky of a way of existing.
Wow. Let's move around the world. Kim Jong-un, evidently Uncle Traitor for all ages.
Man, this is quite a surprise. We heard that he had been basically relieved of duty the other day. We had heard various explanations for why this was, that he was a womanizer, that he used drugs. And then today, a military tribunal sentenced him to death and promptly carried out the execution right there on the spot. I believe he was hanged. This is Uncle Jang Song Pak. I'm looking at a North Korean state media article, which is, maybe I'll try to link it over to you, brilliant creative writing. I'll read a quote which said, "The despicable human scum Jang, who was worse than a dog, perpetrated thrice cursed acts of treachery in betrayal of such profound trust and warmest paternal love shown by the party and the leader." So the uncle has been off. This type of news is hard to put in context without a little bit more background. Often takes a little bit of time to know, you know, why North Korea has moved decisively in one direction or another until a few weeks later when we see, there was a political crisis going on. But many people have already tried to put things together and say that it's not kind of insecurity that this wouldn't be happening unless there was, a political crisis, perhaps a coup of some sort, or a real challenge to Kim Jong-un's leadership. So time will tell, but the uncle is no longer around.
Or, Thanksgiving was just not too long ago. Maybe he ate the last of the pumpkin pie. Who knows? I mean, because, when I read this, I'm looking at this, I'm going, yeah, this guy's pretty much nuts. To begin with, comes from crazy. Does he really need an excuse? Just make something up and, traitor for all ages. I don't know. I'm just fortunate I don't live there.
Yeah, there were some jokes made, and I guess it's never really funny to joke about any death of these types, but people saying, being executed by Kim Jong-un isn't such a surprise when that's essentially what life in North Korea is like day to day. So, obviously, we'll have to spend more time in the coming weeks investigating the context for this, but at the moment, a little bit hard to figure out why this action occurred.
And it's always fun to look at the North Korean state media.
I wrote some stories on them earlier this year when they released the video of Kim Jong-un touring some forward military positions along the border with South Korea. It was in the middle of the winter. He came in on a little boat. I mean, this is a naval ship. They described it. It was like a, outboard motor on a little wooden craft. He had 10 of his sidekicks on there. And as, they didn't even have a dock, so he has to step into the water to make his arrival. And then as you leave, there are dozens and dozens of kind of a horrifying sight. And you realize, what the orders might be getting barked at them from behind the camera as they're shooting. But these soldiers are running over the hill to try to catch up with Kim Jong-un, and then they walk out chest or shoulder high into the freezing cold ocean to try to, and then video explains the sign of their gesture of allegiance, but it is freaky stuff. I'm going to turn into that safety channel.
Yeah. Is it possible that the traitor for all ages maybe had something to do with releasing the 85-year-old guy who wandered into North Korea?
I don't know. I definitely saw that. And, it wouldn't be uncommon for certain outside events to be linked up with this country. But, again, I fortunately have nothing to add or even really anything to speculate with.
If you're 85 years old, what are you doing wandering into North Korea?
There are a lot of, religious folks, and a fair share of wackos who have made North Korea sort of their crusade. So there are lots of border crossings or attempted border crossings and rescues of various types that try to take place along that border zone. So, perhaps that's an explanation for that man's behavior.
Wow. Got to be something. Also, I was watching CNN the other day. I saw these huge barricades coming down in Kiev, where the black helmets and the orange helmets were kind of struggling back and forth till the cops finally. It was interesting TV, but I find it interesting that the people are in the streets wanting to open up lines. The way CNN made it sound, it's about opening up lines of trade.
Yeah, there was actually a very interesting Financial Times op-ed today that sort of said. In a break from the trend we've been seeing with the Eurozone over the past few years, here in Ukraine, you've got a country where people are sort of clamoring for bureaucracy. There are a lot of ways that the European Union becomes entwined with various national governments that certain people start to get bothered by after a number of years being in the Eurozone. But when faced with the possibility of a return back to autocratic rule, I think the bureaucracy and some of the political, complications of the European Union look like heaven by comparison. And sort of the sentiment the former president of Poland, Aleksander Kwasniewski, who's been the EU negotiator trying to get Ukraine into the EU for a number of years now, was interviewed by Der Spiegel today. He said, very interesting, as you break down the population of Ukraine, where in certain areas, I don't know the geography too well, but it's sort of a bifurcated country where you've got on the eastern side this Crimean peninsula that is culturally Russian. And there, the local population wants Russia to actually get involved militarily. They're so closely aligned with that culture. They look to Moscow for political leadership that they want Moscow to come in and restore order to Ukraine. Whereas in the other side of the country, you've got European cities that the mayors there no longer want to even listen to the central government of the country. They're sort of a breakaway province in the other direction. So this country is getting sort of pulled apart over this issue, but it does look like the opposition does have the upper hand at this point. They forced the president to basically say he's going to pick up the integration path with the European Union for so the political pressure from the EU, and as recently as it is, just as recently of the United States, be having some effect in getting Ukraine back in the direction of the EU.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch, and I just thought it was interesting over the issue that you would have that kind of protest and really very structurally sound barriers that it took the police with chainsaws and bulldozers to try and bring it down. They got it halfway down, and then they built it back up again. I just thought it was very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I'd heard about people bringing in big bags of snow and then pouring water over them and then letting them turn into basically these sort of reinforced, sculpted ice walls. I mean, that is, you think it's bad enough going out there with an axe trying to cut apart a little wooden barricade, picking apart ice, if you're a police officer at the middle of the night in the Ukraine where the temperatures are just above zero, doesn't sound like a very a task that would, you know, make me want to keep pursuing my job with even bigger. So, you know, sentiment, again, looks like they're shifting behind the protesters at this point. Could be a lot of reasons.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I, the guy out there with no clothes on was quite an interesting sight. He had like a little rag around his waist, but the rest of him, no clothes on. And like you said, it's near zero. And you go, okay, must really believe in that. And finally, it looks like an Iranian city has elected the first female mayor.
I didn't see that. That's very interesting.
You know, I found it kind of interesting. The city of Kalat, K-A-L-A-T, elected a 26-year-old woman.
You know, it's interesting. I just retweeted something the other day from an Iranian reporter, a male reporter, who had been highlighting the way female journalists are treated in Iran. And, you know, it's a country where it's certainly not gender equality, and all the female journalists were forced to sit on the ground in the aisles of the press center where all the male reporters took their seats. So certainly a country where you know, the election of a female mayor in this case has incredible importance and really is quite unusual.
Yeah, well, maybe there's hope after all. Luke, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Take care. Have a great night.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seem limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education,
commerce.
Commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
I generally don't like to make light of someone's major screw-up on a national stage, but that never gets old. I mean, really, especially when you're talking about a guy who really wants to systematically destroy this nation. Because they have this bizarre view, and I guess like any of the models that you see ideologues pursuing, that if we just give enough to the very well-to-do, they'll take care of us. Look, if we give them enough tax cuts, they'll create jobs. Right? Isn't that what we hear? Amazing stuff. Good news today. You know, and I go back to this Family Act, health insurance, this family insurance for people who, you know, I go back to myself. You know, when I took family medical leave with each of my kids and with a sick relative, I go back to that and I go, you know, had it been compensated on some level. Now, it's only a maximum of $1,000 a week, which, you know, I made much more than that at the time. It would have made it a little bit easier, and I probably would have taken a little bit longer. And that's where maybe the arguments that the people who will stay out of the entire 12 weeks. And I go, you know, maybe isn't that really why we do it? I mean, think about the family values angle, and I'm going to be talking about this because I've talked about it in the past, but this is something I'm going to be focusing on in the new year because, you know, if you're going to say, you know, we're this grand Christian nation, family values, blah, 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 shouldn't your laws reflect that? Shouldn't the priorities of the nation reflect that? And if we're going to, and this is where, you know, I reach out to my really very conservative pro-life friends who say, you know, we need to make sure the baby's born. I go, okay, I'm with you. Okay, make sure they're born. What after? Because I find that a lot of my pro-life friends, not so much on the pro-life front when it comes to bombing people, especially brown people, but more just pro-birth. And then it breaks down, and it's not even just pro-birth. It's pro-control. Pro-punishment. Well, those women, they should have to have those children. And I'm okay, let's say we do. Let's say we force them to have it. What happens to the kids? So those things that I think I deem necessary, you know, make sure that you have the ability to afford them, feed them, clothe them, educate them, get them health care when they get sick. All of those things, if you put those in place, I think it's much easier as a parent to go, yeah, I want to bring children into this world. And this is this Family Act, part of it, a very small part of it, but saying that the first several weeks of life are that important that we're going to, as a society, say, sorry, business leaders, you can do without that employee for a couple of weeks. It's not that important. What is important? Well, training that next generation. Making sure that next generation is loved and nurtured and cared for. I know those are such radical. I'm just such a fancy pants lefty liberal. Really, I get it. Yeah, I mean, how dare I want to actually talk about the family unit and caring for them? Wow, what a concept! How dare I? That's America. We don't do that here. Or at least that's what the rest of the world looks at us and thinks. When you're in the company of Swaziland and Papua New Guinea, which I, you know, maybe my kids can find it on the globe because they're studying it, but I would guarantee the vast majority of Americans can't find those. That's the company we're in, folks. 1, 2, and 3, us and them. And the sad thing is it's not going to pass. I mean, that's the thing that blows my mind. The people who say, well, we're pro-family, ain't going to pass. That's why we got to fight. That's why we've got to organize, and that's why we got to push. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Thanks for being here tonight. I'll be back tomorrow. Pat will be sitting in tomorrow. Treat her well. See you again.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath me.
But maybe, you know, maybe by tomorrow we'll work out some weekend outreach or something like that. Todd, I really appreciate you.